Jack Vance, The Miracle Workers. A seminal figure, Jack Vance has produced some of the very best work of the last 40 years in several different genres, and is of immense evolutionary importance to the development both of modern fantasy and of modern science fiction. Born in San Francisco in 1920, Vance served throughout World War II in the U.S. Merchant Navy. Most of the individual stories that would later be melded into his first novel, The Dying Earth, were written while Vance was at sea. He was unable to sell them, a problem he would also have with the book itself, the market for fantasy being almost non-existent at the time. The Dying Earth was eventually published in an obscure edition in 1950 by a small, semi-professional press, went out of print almost immediately, and remained out of print for more than a decade thereafter. Nevertheless, it became an underground cult classic, and its effect on future generations of writers is incalculable. For one example, out of many, The Dying Earth is one of the most recognizable influences on Gene Wolfe's The Book of the New Sun. Wolfe has said, for instance, that the Book of Gold, which is mentioned by Severian, is supposed to be The Dying Earth. Vance returned to this milieu in 1965 with a series of stories that would be melded into The Eyes of the Overworld, and in the early 80s returned yet again with Hugel's Saga and Rialto the Marvelous. Taken together, the Dying Earth stories represent one of the most impressive achievements in science fantasy. In science fiction itself, Vance would do some of his best early work for magazines such as Thrilling Wonder Stories and Startling Stories and the short-lived Worlds Beyond in the mid-50s, The Five Gold Bands, Abercrombie Station, The Houses of Izam, The Kokod Warriors, The New Prime, and the magazine version of Big Planet, among others. Vance was also appearing in Astounding from time to time during this period, but most of his work for Astounding would be rather bland by Vance's standards, with only one story there, the wonderfully evocative, marvelously strange, and bizarrely imaginative novella that follows, The Miracle Workers, being full-throated Vancean future Baroque. But that was a somewhat atypical style for Astounding, and by the late 50s and early 60s, Vance was doing most of his best work, and some of the very best work of the period, for Galaxy and FNSF, The Magnificent, The Dragon Masters, The Men Return, the underrated The Long of Bao, one of only a handful of books even today to deal with semantics as a science. Delaney's Babel 17 and Ian Watson's The Embedding are two later examples. The wonderful The Star King and The Killing Machine, two of the best hybrids of SF and the mystery espionage novel ever written. Green Magic, The Blue World, The Last Castle. Vance is reminiscent of R.A. Lafferty in that both men break all the supposed rules of writing and get away with it. Both eschew naturalism, each using a mannered and highly idiosyncratic prose style, baroque and stiffly elegant in Vance's case, energetically informal and folksy in Lafferty's, and both have their characters spout theatrical, deliberately non-naturalistic, hieratic dialogue of a sort that never actually came out of anyone's mouth. If you were to film their work, no mumbling method actors would need to apply. Only someone with the flamboyant grandiloquence of a John Barrymore would do. Vance also, and here comes an even stranger comparison, reminds me of Philip K. Dick. Each author relies heavily on a personal formula of his own, using the same basic frameworks, plots, and types of characters and situations again and again. What is important in each is not creating new motifs, but refining and developing variations on their obsessive themes. Each man's style is limited in technical range, but within that range, they are the best in the business at what they do well. Both emphasize how manners and mores change from society to society, and although neither is thought of as a humorist, the work of both is suffused with a dry, understated wit. Vance's humor is somewhat drier than Dick's. Dick's more surreal than Vance's. But both tend toward black humor, sly satire, a bitterly sardonic view of life and human nature, and to grotesque and macabrely ironic set pieces. Both men have trouble ending novels, both frequently just letting the story peter away, as though they had gradually lost interest in what they were writing. And with each, their impact on the field rests more on the aggregate effect of their work than on any particular story or novel. or, to adapt a remark of Thomas Dish's concerning Dick, which is equally valid for Vance, their novels are more impressive collectively than each by each. And much as SF authors writing today about phenomenology or the nature of reality write inevitably in the shadow of Philip K. Dick, so writers describing distant worlds and alien societies with strange alien customs write in the shadow of Vance. No one in the history of the field has brought more intelligence, imagination, or inexhaustible fertility of invention to that theme than Vance. Even ostensible potboilers such as his Planet of Adventure series are full of vivid and richly portrayed alien societies and bizarre and often profoundly disturbing insights into the ways in which human psychology might be altered by immersion in alien values and cultural systems. No one is better than Vance is at delivering that quintessential sense of wonder that is at the heart of science fiction, and reading him has left me a legacy of evocative images that will stay with me forever. Vance has won 2 Hugo Awards, a Nebula Award, 2 World Fantasy Awards, 1 the prestigious Life Achievement Award, and the Edgar Award for Best Mystery Novel. His other books include Inferio, one of the best novels of the late 60s, up until the disappointing ending, The Enemy, The Palace of Love, The Face, The Book of Dreams, City of the Chash, The Deer Deer, The Noom, The Brave Free Men, Lioness, The Green Pearl, Trollian, Alastor 2262, Whist, Alastor 1716, and Araminta Station, among many others. His short fiction has been collected in 8 Phantasms and Magics, The Best of Jack Vance, Green Magic, Lost Moons, The Complete Magnus Ridolf, The World Between and Other Stories, The Dark Side of the Moon, and The Narrow Land. His most recent book is the novel Throy. 1. The war party from Faid Keep moved eastward across the downs. A column of 100 armored knights, 500 foot soldiers, a train of wagons. In the lead rode Lord Faid, a tall man in his early maturity, spare and cat-like, with a sallow, dyspeptic face. He sat in the ancestral car of the Faids, a boat-shaped vehicle floating 2 feet above the moss, and carried, in addition to his sword and dagger, his ancestral side weapons. An hour before sunset, a pair of scouts came racing back to the column, their club-headed horses loping like dogs. Lord Faid braked the motion of his car. Behind him, the Faid kinsmen, the lesser knights, the leather-capped foot soldiers, halted. To the rear, the baggage train and the high-wheeled wagons of the Jinx men creaked to a stop. The scouts approached at breakneck speed, at the last instant flinging their horses sidewise. Long, shaggy legs kicked out, pad-like hooves plowed through the moss. The scouts jumped to the ground, ran forward. "The way to Balant Keep is blocked!" Lord Faid rose in his seat, stood staring eastward over the gray-green downs. "How many knights? How many men?" "No knights, no men, Lord Faid. The first folk have planted a forest between North and South Wildwood." Lord Faid stood a moment in reflection, then seated himself, pushed the control knob. The car wheezed, jerked, moved forward. The knights touched up their horses. The foot soldiers resumed their slouching gait. At the rear, the baggage train creaked into motion, together with the 6 wagons of the Jinxmen. The sun, large, pale, and faintly pink, sank in the west. North Wildwood loomed down from the left, separated from South Wildwood by an area of stony ground, only sparsely patched with moss. As the sun passed behind the horizon, the new planting became visible, a frail new growth connecting the tracts of woodland like a canal between 2 seas. Lord Faid halted his car, stepped down to the moss. He appraised the landscape, then gave the signal to make camp. The wagons were ranged in a circle, the gear unloaded. Lord Faid watched the activity for a moment, eyes sharp and critical, then turned and walked out across the downs through the lavender and green twilight. 15 miles to the east, his last enemy awaited him, Lord Balant of Balant Keep. Contemplating tomorrow's battle, Lord Faid felt reasonably confident of the outcome. His troops had been tempered by 12 campaigns. His kinsmen were loyal and single-hearted. Head Jinxman to Faid Keep was Hein Huss, and associated with him were three of the most powerful jinxmen of Pangborn: Isaac Commandore, Adam McAdam, and the remarkable Enterlin, together with their separate troops of cabalmen, spellbinders, and apprentices. Altogether, an impressive assemblage. Certainly there were obstacles to be overcome. Ballant Keep was strong. Lord Ballant would fight obstinately. Anderson Grimes, the Ballant jinxman, was efficient and highly respected. There was also this nuisance of the First Folk and the new planting which closed the gap between North and South Wildwood. The First Folk were a pale and feeble race, no match for human beings in single combat, but they guarded their forests with traps and deadfalls. Lord Faid cursed softly under his breath. To circle either North or South Wildwood meant a delay of 3 days, which could not be tolerated. Lord Faid returned to the camp. Fires were alight, pots bubbled, orderly rows of sleep holes had been dug into the moss. The knights groomed their horses within the corral of wagons. Lord Faid's own tent had been erected on a hummock beside the ancient car. Lord Faid made a quick round of inspection, noting every detail, speaking no word. The jinxmen were encamped a little distance apart from the troops. The apprentices and lesser spellbinders prepared food, while the jinxmen and cabalmen worked inside their tents, arranging cabinets and cases, correcting whatever disorder had been caused by the jolting of the wagons. Lord Faid entered the tent of his head jinxman. Hinehus was an enormous man, with arms and legs heavy as tree trunks, a torso like a barrel. His face was pink and placid, his eyes were water clear. A stiff gray brush rose from his head, which was innocent of the cap jinxmen customarily wore against the loss of hair. Hinehus disdained such precautions. It was his habit, showing his teeth in a face-splitting grin, to rumble, "Why should anyone hoodoo me, old Hinehus? I am so inoffensive. Whoever tried would surely die of shame and remorse." Lord Faid found Huss busy at his cabinet. The doors stood wide, revealing hundreds of mannequins, each tied with a lock of hair, a bit of cloth, a fingernail clipping, daubed with grease, sputum, excrement, blood. Lord Faid knew well that one of these mannequins represented himself. He also knew that should he request it, Hein Huss would deliver it without hesitation. Part of Huss's mana derived from his enormous confidence, the effortless ease of his power. He glanced at Lord Faid and read the question in his mind.
Lord Ballant did not know of the new planting. Anderson Grimes has now informed him, and Lord Ballant expects that you will be delayed. Grimes has communicated with Gisborne Keep and Castle Cloud. 300 men march tonight to reinforce Ballant Keep. They will arrive in 2 days. Lord Ballant is much elated.
Lord Faid paced back and forth across the tent.
Can we cross this planting?
Hein Huss made a heavy sound of disapproval.
There are many futures. In certain of these futures you pass, in others you do not pass. I cannot ordain these futures.
Lord Faid had long learned to control his impatience at what sometimes seemed to be pedantic obfuscation. He grumbled,
They are either very stupid or very bold, planting across the downs in this fashion. I cannot imagine what they intend.
Hein Huss considered, then grudgingly volunteered an idea.
What if they plant west from North Wildwood to Sarrow Copse? What if they plant west from South Wildwood to Old Forest?
Lord Faid stood stock still, his eyes narrow and thoughtful.
Faid Keep would be surrounded by forest. We would be imprisoned.
These plantings, do they proceed? They proceed, so I have been told.
What do they hope to gain?
I do not know. Perhaps they hope to isolate the keeps, to rid the planet of men. Perhaps they merely want secure avenues between the forests.
Lord Faid considered. Huss's final suggestion was reasonable enough. During the first centuries of human settlement, sportive young men had hunted the First Folk with clubs and lances, eventually had driven them from their native downs into the forests.
Evidently, they are more clever than we realize. Adam McAdam asserts that they do not think, but it seems that he is mistaken.
Hein Huss shrugged.
Adam McAdam equates thought to the human cerebral process.
He cannot telepathize with the first folk, hence he deduced that they do not think. But I have watched them at Forest Market, and they trade intelligently enough.
He raised his head, appeared to listen, then reached into his cabinet, delicately tightened a noose around the neck of one of the mannequins. From outside the tent came a sudden cough and a whooping gasp for air. Huss grinned, twitched open the noose.
That is Isaac Commandori's apprentice. He hopes to complete a Hein Huss mannequin. I must say he works diligently, going so far as to touch its feet into my footprints whenever possible.
Lord Fayed went to the flap of the tent.
We break camp early. Be alert. I may require your help.
Lord Fayed departed the tent. Hein Huss continued the ordering of the cabinet. Presently he sensed the approach of his rival, Jinxman Isaac Commandori, who coveted the office of head Jinxman with all-consuming passion. Huss closed the cabinet and hoisted himself to his feet. Commandori entered the tent, a man tall, crooked, and spindly. His wedge-shaped head was covered with coarse russet ringlets. Hot red-brown eyes peered from under his red eyebrows.
I offer my complete rights to Kirill, and will include the masks, the headdress, and amulets. Of all the demons ever contrived, he has won the widest public acceptance. To utter the name, Kirill, is to complete half the work of a possession. Kirill is a valuable property. I can give no more.
But Huss shook his head. Commandori's desire was the full simulacrum of Tharan Fayed, Lord Fayed's oldest son, complete with clothes, hair, skin, eyelashes, tears, excreta, sweat, and sputum. The only one in existence, for Lord Fayed guarded his son much more jealously than he did himself.
You offer convincingly, said Huss, but my own demons suffice. The name Dant conveys fully as much terror as Kirill.
I will add 5 heirs from the head of Jinxman Clarence Sears. They are the last, for he is now stark bald.
Let us drop the matter. I will keep the simulacrum.
As you please, said Commandori with asperity. He glanced out the flap of the tent. That blundering apprentice, he puts the feet of the mannequin backwards into your prints.
Huss opened his cabinet, thumped the mannequin with his finger. From outside the tent came a grunt of surprise. Huss grinned.
He is young and earnest, and perhaps he is clever. Who knows?
He went to the flap of the tent, called outside.
Hey, Sam Salazar, what do you do? Come inside.
Apprentice Sam Salazar came blinking into the tent, a thick-set youth with a round, florid face, overhung with a rather untidy mass of straw-colored hair. In one hand he carried a crude, pot-bellied mannequin, evidently intended to represent Hein Huss.
You puzzle both your master and myself, said Huss. There must be method in your folly, but we fail to perceive it. For instance, this moment you place my simulacrum backwards into my track, I feel a tug on my foot. And you pay for your clumsiness.
Sam Salazar showed small evidence of abashment.
Jinxman Commandori is warned that we must expect to suffer for our ambitions. If your ambition is jinxmanship, Commandori declared sharply, you had best mend your ways.
The lad is craftier than you know, said Hein Huss. Look now.
He took the mannequin, spit into its mouth, plucked a hair from his head, thrust it into a convenient crevice.
He has a Hein Huss mannequin, achieved at very small cost. Now, Apprentice Salazar, how will you hoodoo me?
Naturally, I would never dare. I merely want to fill the bare spaces in my cabinet.
Hein Huss nodded his approval.
As good a reason as any. Of course, you own a simulacrum of Isaac Commandori.
Sam Salazar glanced uneasily sidewise at Isaac Commandori.
He leaves none of his traces. If there is so much as an open bottle in the room, he breathes behind his hand.
Ridiculous, exclaimed Hein Huss. Commandori, what do you fear?
I am conservative, said Commandori dryly. You make a fine gesture, but some day an enemy may own that simulacrum. Then you will regret your bravado.
Bah! My enemies are all dead, save one or two who dare not reveal themselves.
He clapped Sam Salazar a great buffet on the shoulder.
Tomorrow, Apprentice Salazar, great things are in store for you.
What manner of great things?
Honor, noble self-sacrifice. Lord Faid must beg permission to pass Wildwood from the first folk, which galls him. But beg he must. Tomorrow, Sam Salazar, I will elect you to lead the way to the Pauly, to deflect deadfalls, scythes, and nettle traps from the more important person who follows.
Sam Salazar shook his head and drew back.
There must be others more worthy. I prefer to ride in the rear with the wagons.
Commandore waved him from the tent.
You will do as ordered. Leave us. We have had enough apprentice talk.
Sam Salazar departed. Commandore turned back to Hein Huss.
In connection with tomorrow's battle, Anderson Grimes is especially adept with demons. As I recall, he has developed and successfully publicized Font, who spread sleep, Everid, a being of wrath, Dania, a force of fear. We must take care that encountering these effects, we do not neutralize each other.
True, rumbled Huss. I have long maintained to Lord Faid that a single jinxman, the head jinxman, in fact, is more effective than a group at cross-purposes. But he is consumed by ambition and does not listen.
Perhaps he wants to be sure that, should advancing years overtake the head jinxman, other equally effective jinxmen are at hand.
The future has many paths,
agreed Hein Huss.
Lord Faid is well advised to seek early for my successor, so that I may train him over the years. I plan to assess all the subsidiary jinxmen and select the most promising. Tomorrow I relegate to you the demons of Anderson Grimes.
Isaac Commandore nodded politely.
You are wise to give over responsibility. When I feel the weight of my years, I hope I may act with similar forethought. Good night, Hein Huss. I go to arrange my demon masks. Tomorrow, Kiro must walk like a giant.
Good night, Isaac Commandore.
Commandore swept from the tent, and Huss settled himself on his stool. Sam Salazar scratched at the flap.
Well, lad, growled Huss, why do you loiter?
Sam Salazar placed the Hein Huss mannequin on the table.
I have no wish to keep this doll.
Throw it in a ditch, then,
Hein Huss spoke gruffly.
You must stop annoying me with stupid tricks. You efficiently obtrude yourself upon my attention, but you cannot transfer from Commandore's troop without his express consent.
If I gain his consent?
You will incur his enmity. He will open his cabinet against you. Unlike myself, you are vulnerable to a hoodoo. I advise you to be content. Isaac Commandore is highly skilled and can teach you much.
Sam Salazar still hesitated.
Jinxman Commandore, though skilled, is intolerant of new thoughts.
Hein Huss shifted ponderously on a stool, examined Sam Salazar with his water-clear eyes.
What new thoughts are these? Your own?
The thoughts are new to me, and for all I know, new to Isaac Commandore. But he will say neither yes nor no.
Hein Huss sighed, settled his monumental bulk more comfortably.
Speak, then, describe these thoughts, and I will assess their novelty.
First, I have wondered about trees. They are sensitive to light, to moisture, to wind, to pressure. Sensitivity implies sensation. Might a man feel into the soul of a tree for these sensations? If a tree were capable of awareness, this faculty might prove useful. A man might select trees as sentinels and strategic sites, and enter into them as he chose.
Hein Huss was skeptical.
An amusing notion, but practically not feasible. The reading of minds, the act of possession, televoyance, similar interplay, requires psychic congruence as a basic condition. Their minds must be able to become identities at some particular stratum. Unless there is sympathy, there is no linkage. A tree is at opposite poles from a man. The images of tree and man are incommensurable. Hence, anything more than the most trifling flicker of comprehension must be a true miracle of jinxmanship.
Sam Salazar nodded mournfully.
I realized this, and at one time hoped to equip myself with the necessary identification.
To do this, you must become a vegetable. Certainly the tree will never become a man.
So I reasoned, said Sam Salazar. I went alone into a grove of trees where I chose a tall conifer. I buried my feet in the mold. I stood silent and naked, in the sunlight and the rain, at dawn, noon, dusk, midnight. I closed my mind to man thoughts. I closed my eyes to vision, my ears to sound. I took no nourishment except from rain and sun. I sent roots forth from my feet and branches from my torso. 30 hours I stood, and 2 days later, another 30 hours. And after 2 days, another 30 hours, I made myself a tree, as nearly as possible to one of flesh and blood.
Einhaus gave the great inward gurgle which signalized his amusement.
And you achieved sympathy?
Nothing useful, Sam Salazar admitted. I felt something of the tree's sensations, the activity of light, the peace of dark, the coolness of rain. But visual and auditory experience? Nothing. However, I do not regret the trial. It was a useful discipline.
An interesting effort, even if inconclusive. The idea is by no means of startling originality, but the empiricism, to use an archaic word, of your method is bold, and no doubt antagonized Isaac Komandori, who has no patience with the superstitions of our ancestors. I suspect that he harangued you against frivolity, metaphysics, and inspirationalism.
True, said Sam Salazar. He spoke at length.
You should take the lesson to heart. Isaac Komandori is sometimes unable to make the most obvious truth seem credible. However, I cite you the example of Lord Faid, who considers himself an enlightened man, free from superstition. Still, he rides in the feeble car. He carries a pistol 1,600 years old. He relies on Hellmouth to protect Faid Keep.
Perhaps, unconsciously, he longs for the old magical times, suggested Sam Salazar thoughtfully.
Perhaps,
agreed Einhaus.
And you do likewise?
Sam Salazar hesitated. There is an aura of romance, a kind of wild grandeur to the old days. But of course, he added quickly, mysticism is no substitute for orthodox logic.
Naturally not, agreed Einhaus. Now go. I must consider the events of tomorrow.
Sam Salazar departed, and Einhaus, rumbling and groaning, hoisted himself to his feet. He went to the flap of his tent, surveyed the camp. All now was quiet. The fires were embers, the warriors lay in the pits they had cut into the moss. To the north and south spread the woodlands. Among the trees and out on the downs were faint flickering luminosities, where the first folk gathered sporopods from the moss. Einhaus became aware of a nearby personality. He turned his head and saw approaching the shrouded form of Jinxman Enterlin, who concealed his face, who spoke only in whispers, who disguised his natural gait with a stiff, stilt-like motion. By this means, he hoped to reduce his vulnerability to hostile Jinxmanship. The admission carelessly let fall, of failing eyesight, of stiff joints, forgetfulness, melancholy, nausea, might be of critical significance in controversy by hoodoo. Jinxmen, therefore, maintained the pose of absolute health and virility, even though they must grope blindly or limp doubled up from cramps. Einhaus called out to Enterlin, lifted back the flap to the tent. Enterlin entered. Huss went to the cabinet, brought forth a flask, poured liquor into a pair of stone cups.
A cordial only, free of covert significance.
Good, whispered Enterlin, selecting the cup farthest from him. After all, we Jinxmen must relax into the guise of men from time to time.
Turning his back on Huss, he introduced the cup through the folds of his hood, drank.
Refreshing, he whispered. We need refreshment. Tomorrow we must work.
Huss issued his reverberating chuckle.
Tomorrow Isaac Komandori matches demons with Anderson Grimes. We others perform only subsidiary duties.
Enterlin seemed to make a quizzical inspection of Einhaus through the black gauze before his eyes.
Komandori will relish this opportunity. His vehemence oppresses me, and his is a power which feeds on success. He is a man of fire. You are a man of ice.
Ice quenches fire.
Fire sometimes melts ice.
Einhaus shrugged.
No matter. I grow weary. Time has passed all of us by. Only a moment ago, a young apprentice showed me to myself.
As a powerful jinxman, as head jinxman to the Faids, you have cause for pride.
Einhaus drained the stone cup, set it aside.
No. I see myself at the top of my profession, with nowhere else to go. Only Sam Salazar the apprentice thinks to search for more universal lore. He comes to me for counsel, and I do not know what to tell him.
Strange talk. Strange talk, whispered Enderlin.
He moved to the flap of the tent.
I go now,
he whispered.
I go to walk on the downs. Perhaps I will see the future.
There are many futures.
Enderlin rustled away and was lost in the dark. Einhaus groaned and grumbled, then took himself to his couch, where he instantly fell asleep. 2. The night passed. The sun, flickering with films of pink and green, lifted over the horizon. The new planting of the first folk was silhouetted, a sparse stubble of saplings against the green and lavender sky. The troops broke camp with practiced efficiency. Lord Faid marched to his car, leaped within. The machine sagged under his weight. He pushed a button. The car drifted forward, heavy as a waterlogged timber. A mile from the new planting, he halted, sent a messenger back to the wagons of the Jinxmen. Einhaus walked ponderously forward, followed by Isaac Commandori, Adam McAdam, and Enterlin. Lord Faid spoke to Einhaus.
Send someone to speak to the first folk. Inform them we wish to pass, offering them no harm, but that we will react savagely to any hostility. I will go myself, said Einhaus.
He turned to Commandori.
Lend me, if you will, your brash young apprentice. I can put him to good use.
If he unmasks a nettle trap by blundering into it, his first useful deed will be done, said Commandori.
He signaled to Sam Salazar, who came reluctantly forward.
Walk in front of head jinxman Einhaus, that he may encounter no traps or scythes. Take a staff to probe the moss.
Without enthusiasm, Sam Salazar borrowed a lance from one of the foot soldiers. He and Huss set forth along the low rise that previously had separated North from South Wildwood. Occasionally, outcroppings of stone penetrated the cover of moss. Here and there grew bayberry trees, clumps of tar plant, ginger tea, and rosewort. A half mile from the planting, Huss halted.
Now take care, for here the traps will begin. Walk clear of hummocks. These often conceal swing scythes. Avoid moss, which shows a pale blue. It is dying or sickly and may cover a deadfall or a nettle trap.
Why cannot you locate the traps by clairvoyance?
Asked Sam Salazar in a rather sullen voice.
It appears an excellent occasion for the use of these faculties.
The question is natural, said Einhaus with composure. However, you must know that when a jinxman's own profit or security is at stake, his emotions play tricks on him. I would see traps everywhere and would never know whether clairvoyance or fear prompted me. In this case, that lance is a more reliable instrument than my mind.
Sam Salazar made a salute of understanding and set forth, with Einhaus stumping behind him. At first he prodded with care, uncovering two traps, then advanced more jauntily, so swiftly indeed that Huss called out in exasperation,
Caution, unless you court death.
Sam Salazar obligingly slowed his pace.
There are traps all around us, but I detect the pattern, or so I believe.
Aha, you do. Reveal it to me, if you will. I am only head jinxman and ignorant.
Notice, if we walk where the spore pods have recently been harvested, then we are secure.
Einhaus grunted.
Forward, then. Why do you dally? We must do battle at Ballant Keep today.
200 yards farther, Sam Salazar stopped short.
Go on, boy, go on, grumbled Einhaus.
The savages threaten us. You can see them just inside the planting. They hold tubes which they point toward us.
Einhaus peered, then raised his head and called out in the sibilant language of the first folk.
A moment or two passed, then one of the creatures came forth. A naked humanoid figure, ugly as a demon mask. Foam sacks bulged under its arms. Orange-lipped foam vents pointed forward. Its back was wrinkled and loose, the skin serving as a bellows to blow air through the foam sacks. The fingers of the enormous hands ended in chisel-shaped blades. The head was sheathed in chitin. Billion-faceted eyes swelled from either side of the head, glowing like black opals, merging without definite limit into the chitin. This was a representative of the original inhabitants of the planet, who, until the coming of man, had inhabited the downs, burrowing in the moss, protecting themselves behind masses of foam exuded from the underarm sacks. The creature wandered close, halted.
"I speak for Lord Faid of Faid Keep," said Huss. "Your planting bars his way. He wishes that you guide him through so that his men do not damage the trees or spring the traps you have set against your enemies."
"Men are our enemies," responded the autochthon. "You may spring as many traps as you care to. That is their purpose." It backed away.
"One moment," said Hein Husk sternly. "Lord Faid must pass. He goes to battle Lord Ballant. He does not wish to battle the First Folk. Therefore, it is wise to guide him across the planting without hindrance."
The creature considered a second or two.
"I will guide him."
He stalked across the moss toward the war party.
Behind followed Hein Huss and Sam Salazar. The autochthon, legs articulated more flexibly than a man's, seemed to weave and wander, occasionally pausing to study the ground ahead.
"I am puzzled," Sam Salazar told Hein Huss. "I cannot understand the creature's actions."
"Small wonder," grunted Hein Huss. "He is one of the First Folk. You are human. There is no basis for understanding."
"I disagree," said Sam Salazar seriously.
"Huh?"
Hein Huss inspected the apprentice with vast disapproval.
"You engage in contention with me, head jinxman Hein Huss?"
"Only in a limited sense," said Sam Salazar. "I see a basis for understanding with the First Folk and our common ambition to survive."
"A truism," grumbled Hein Huss. "Granting this community of interests with the First Folk, what is your perplexity?"
"The fact that it first refused, then agreed to conduct us across the planting."
Hein Huss nodded.
"Evidently the information which intervened, that we go to fight at Ballant Keep, occasioned the change."
"This is clear," said Sam Salazar. "But think..."
"You exhort me to think?" roared Hein Huss.
"Here is one of the First Folk, apparently without distinction, who makes an important decision instantly. Is he one of their leaders? Do they live in anarchy?"
"It is easy to put questions,"
Hein Huss said gruffly.
"It is not as easy to answer them." In short, I do not know. In any event, they are pleased to see us killing one another."
3. The passage through the planting was made without incident. A mile to the east, the autochthon stepped aside and without formality returned to the forest. The war party, which had been marching in single file, regrouped into its usual formation. Lord Faid called Hein Huss and made the unusual gesture of inviting him up into the seat beside him. The ancient car dipped and sagged. The power mechanism whined and chattered. Lord Faid, in high good spirits, ignored the noise.
"I feared that we might be forced into a time-consuming wrangle. What of Lord Ballant? Can you read his thoughts?"
Hein Huss cast his mind forth.
"Not clearly. He knows of our passage. He is disturbed."
Lord Faid laughed sardonically.
"For excellent reasons. Listen now, I will explain the plan of battle so that all may coordinate their efforts." "Very well. We approach in a wide line. Ballant's great weapon is, of course, Volcano. A decoy must wear my armor and ride in the lead. The yellow-haired apprentice is perhaps the most expendable member of the party. In this way, we will learn the potentialities of Volcano. Like our own Hellmouth, it was built to repel vessels from space and cannot command the ground immediately under the keep. Therefore, we will advance in dispersed formation to regroup 200 yards from the keep. At this point, the Jinxmen will impel Lord Ballant forth from the keep. You no doubt have made plans to this end?"
Hein Huss gruffly admitted that such was the case. Like other Jinxmen, he enjoyed the pose that his power sufficed for extemporaneous control of any situation.
Lord Fayed was in no mood for niceties and pressed for further information. Grudging each word, Hein Huss disclosed his arrangements.
I have prepared certain influences to discomfort the Ballant defenders and drive them forth. Jinxman Enterlin will sit at his cabinet, ready to retaliate if Lord Ballant orders a spell against you. Anderson Grimes undoubtedly will cast a demon, probably Everid, into the Ballant warriors. In return, Jinxman Commandori will possess an equal or a greater number of Fayed warriors with the demon Kirill, who is even more ghastly and horrifying.
Good. What more?
There is need for no more if your men fight well. Can you see the future? How does today end? There are many futures. Certain Jinxmen, Entelin, for instance, profess to see the thread which leads through the maze. They are seldom correct.
Call Entelin here.
Hein Huss rumbled his disapproval.
Unwise if you desire victory over Ballant Keep.
Lord Fayed inspected the mass of Jinxmen from under his black saturnine brows.
Why do you say this?
If Entelin foretells defeat, you will be dispirited and fight poorly. If he predicts victory, you become overconfident and likewise fight poorly.
Lord Fayed made a petulant gesture.
The Jinxmen are loud in their boasts until the test is made. Then they always find reasons to retract to qualify.
Aha! Barked Hein Huss. You expect miracles, not honest Jinxmanship. I spit!
He spat.
I predict that the spittle will strike the morse. The probabilities are high. But an insect might fly in the way. One of the first folk might raise through the moss. The chances are slight. In the next instant, there is only one future. A minute hence, there are four futures. 5 minutes hence, 20 futures. A billion futures could not express all the possibilities of tomorrow. Of these billions, certain are more probable than others. It is true that these probable futures sometimes send a delicate influence into the Jinxman's brain. But unless he is completely impersonal and disinterested, his own desires overwhelm this influence. Entelin is a strange man. He hides himself. He has no appetites. Occasionally his auguries are exact. Nevertheless, I advise against consulting him. You do better to rely on the practical and real uses of jinxmanship.
Lord Fayed said nothing. The column had been marching along the bottom of a low swale. The car had been sliding easily downslope. Now they came to a rise, and the power mechanism complained so vigorously that Lord Fayed was compelled to stop the car. He considered.
Once over the crest, we will be in view of Ballant Keep. Now we must disperse. Send the least valuable man in your troop forward, the apprentice who tested out the moss. He must wear my helmet and corselet and ride in the car.
Hein Huss alighted, returned to the wagons, and presently Sam Salazar came forward. Lord Fayed eyed the round, florid face with distaste.
Come close,
he said crisply. Sam Salazar obeyed.
You will now ride in my place, said Lord Fayed. Notice carefully. This rod impels a forward motion. This arm steers, to right, to left. To stop, return the rod to its first position.
Sam Salazar pointed to some of the other arms, toggles, switches, and buttons.
What are these?
They are never used.
And these dials, what is their meaning?
Lord Fayed curled his lip on the brink of one of his quick furies.
Since their use is unimportant to me, it is 20 times unimportant to you. Now, put this cap on your head and this helmet. See to it that you do not sweat.
Sam Salazar gingerly settled the magnificent black and green crest of Fayed on his head with a cloth cap underneath.
Now, this corselet.
The corselet was constructed of green and black metal sequins, with a pair of scarlet dragon heads at either side of the breast.
Now, the cloak.
Lord Fayed flung the black cloak over Sam Salazar's shoulders.
Do not venture too close to Ballant Keep. Your purpose is to attract the fire of Volcano. Maintain a lateral motion around the keep outside of dart range. If you are killed by a dart, the whole purpose of the deception is thwarted.
You prefer me to be killed by Volcano? Inquired Sam Salazar.
No, I wish to preserve the car and the crest. These are relics of great value. Evade destruction by all means possible. The ruse probably will deceive no one, but if it does, and if it draws the fire of Volcano, I must sacrifice the Fayed car. Now, sit in my place.
Sam Salazar climbed into the car, settled himself on the seat.
Sit straight, roared Lord Fayed. Hold your head up. You are simulating Lord Fayed. You must not appear to slink.
Sam Salazar heaved himself erect in the seat.
To simulate Lord Fayed most effectively, I should walk among the warriors with someone else riding in the car.
Lord Fayed glared, then grinned sourly.
No matter. Do as I have commanded. 4. 1600 years before, with war raging through space, a group of space captains, their home bases destroyed, had taken refuge on Pangborn. To protect themselves against vengeful enemies, they built great forts armed with weapons from their dismantled spaceships. The wars receded. Pangborn was forgotten. The newcomers drove the first folk into the forests, planted and harvested the river valleys. Ballant Keep, like Faid Keep, Castle Cloud, Boghoten, and the rest overlooked one of these valleys. 4 squat towers of a dense black substance supported an enormous parasol roof and were joined by walls two-thirds as high as the towers. At the peak of the roof, a cupola housed a volcano, the weapon corresponding to Faid's Hellmouth. The Faid war party, advancing over the rise, found the great gates already secure, the parapets between the towers thronged with bowmen. According to Lord Faid's strategy, the war party advanced on a broad front. At the center rode Sam Salazar, resplendent in Lord Faid's armor. He made, however, small effort to simulate Lord Faid. Rather than sitting proudly erect, he crouched at the side of the seat, the crest canted at an angle. Lord Faid watched with disgust. Apprentice Salazar's reluctance to be demolished was understandable. If his impersonation failed to convince Lord Ballant, at least the Faid ancestral car might be spared. For a certainty, Volcano was being manned. The Ballant weapon tender could be seen in the cupola, and the snout protruded at a menacing angle. Apparently, the tactic of dispersal, offering no single tempting target, was effective. The Faid war party advanced quickly to a point 200 yards from the keep, below Volcano's effective field, without drawing fire. First the knights, then the foot soldiers, then the rumbling wagons of the magicians. The slow-moving Faid car was far outdistanced. Any doubt as to the nature of the ruse must now be extinguished. Apprentice Salazar, disliking the isolation and hoping to increase the speed of the car, twisted one of the other switches, then another. From under the floor came a thin screeching sound. The car quivered and began to rise. Sam Salazar peered over the side, threw out a leg to jump. Lord Faid ran forward, gesturing and shouting. Sam Salazar hastily drew back his leg, returned the switches to their previous condition. The car dropped like a rock. He snapped the switches up again, cushioning the fall.
"Get out of that car!" roared Lord Faid.
He snatched away the helmet, dealt Sam Salazar a buffet which toppled him head over heels.
"Out of the armor! Back to your duties!"
Sam Salazar hurried to the Jinxman's wagons, where he helped erect Isaac Komondori's black tent. Inside the tent, a black carpet with red and yellow patterns was laid. Commandori's cabinet, his chair, and his chest were carried in, and incense set burning in a censer. Directly in front of the main gate, Hein Huss superintended the assembly of a rolling stage, 40 feet tall and 60 feet long, the surface concealed from Ballant Keep by a tarpaulin. Meanwhile, Lord Faid had dispatched an emissary, enjoining Lord Ballant to surrender. Lord Ballant delayed his response, hoping to delay the attack as long as possible. If he could maintain himself a day and a half, reinforcements from Gisborne Keep and Castle Cloud might force Lord Faid to retreat. Lord Faid waited only until the Jinxmen had completed their preparations, then sent another messenger, offering 2 more minutes in which to surrender. 1 minute passed. 2 minutes. The envoys turned on their heels, marched back to the camp. Lord Faid spoke to Hein Huss.
"You are prepared?"
"I am prepared," rumbled Hein Huss.
"Drive them forth."
Huss raised his arm. The tarpaulin dropped from the face of his great display to reveal a painted representation of Ballant Keep. Huss retired to his tent and pulled the flaps together. Braziers burnt fiercely, illuminating the faces of Adam McAdam, 8 cabalmen, and 6 of the most advanced spellbinders. Each worked at a bench supporting several dozen dolls and a small glowing brazier. The cabalmen and spellbinders worked with dolls representing Ballant men-at-arms. Huss and Adam McAdam employed simulacra of the Ballant knights. Lord Ballant would not be hoodooed unless he ordered a jinx against Lord Faid, a courtesy the keep lords extended each other. Huss called out,
"Sebastian!"
Sebastian, one of Huss's spellbinders, waiting at the flap to the tent, replied,
"Ready, sir."
"Begin the display."
Sebastian ran to the stage, struck fire to a fuse. Watchers inside Ballant Keep saw the depicted keep take fire. Flame erupted from the windows. The roof glowed and crumbled. Inside the tent, the two jinxmen, the cabalmen, and the spellbinders methodically took dolls, dipped them into the heat of the braziers, concentrating, reaching out for the mind of the man whose doll they burnt. Within the keep, men became uneasy. Many began to imagine burning sensations, which became more severe as their minds grew more sensitive to the idea of fire. Lord Ballant noted the uneasiness. He signaled to his chief jinxman, Anderson Grimes.
Begin the counterspell.
Down the front of the keep unrolled a display even larger than Hein Husser's, depicting a hideous beast. It stood on four legs and was shown picking up two men in a pair of hands, biting off their heads. Grimes's cabal men, meanwhile, took up dolls representing the Fa'id warriors, inserted them into the models of the depicted beast, and closed the hinged jaws, all the while projecting ideas of fear and disgust. And the Fa'id warriors, staring at the depicted monster, felt a sense of horror and weakness. Inside Huss's tent, censers and braziers reeked and dolls smoked. Eyes stared, brows glistened. From time to time, one of the workers gasped, signaling the entry of his projection into an enemy mind. Within the keep, warriors began to mutter, to slap at burning skin, to eye each other fearfully, noting each other's symptoms. Finally, one cried out and tore at his armor.
I burn! The cursed witches burn me!
His pain aggravated the discomfort of the others. There was a growing sound throughout the keep. Lord Ballant's oldest son, his mind penetrated by Hein Huss himself, struck his shield with his mailed fist.
They burn me! They burn us all! Better to fight than burn! Fight! Fight!
Came the voices of the tormented men. Lord Ballant looked around at the twisted faces, some displaying blisters, scald marks.
Our own spell terrifies them. Wait yet a moment, he pleaded.
His brother called hoarsely,
It is not your belly that Hein Huss toasts in the flames, it is mine! We cannot win a battle of hoodoos. We must win a battle of arms.
Lord Ballant cried it desperately.
Wait, our own effects are working. They will flee in terror. Wait, wait.
His cousin tore off his corslet.
It's Hein Huss. I feel him. My legs in the fire. The devil laughs at me. Next my head, he says. Fight or I go forth to fight alone.
Very well, said Lord Ballant in a fateful voice. We go forth to fight. First the beast goes forth. Then we follow and smite them in their terror.
The gates to the keep swung suddenly wide. Out sprang what appeared to be the depicted monster, legs moving, arms waving, eyes rolling, issuing evil sounds. Normally, the Fa'id warriors would have seen the monster for what it was, a model carried on the backs of three horses. But their minds had been influenced. They had been infected with horror. They drew back with arms hanging flaccid. From behind the monster, the Ballant knights galloped, followed by the Ballant foot soldiers. The charge gathered momentum, tore into the Fa'id center. Lord Fa'id bellowed orders. Discipline asserted itself. The Fa'id knights disengaged, divided into three platoons, and engulfed the Ballant charge, while the foot soldiers poured darts into the advancing ranks. There was the clatter and surge of battle. Lord Ballant, seeing that his sally had failed to overwhelm the Fa'id forces, and thinking to conserve his own forces, ordered a retreat. In good order, the Ballant warriors began to back up toward the keep. The Fa'id knights held close contact, hoping to win to the courtyard. Close behind came a heavily loaded wagon pushed by armored horses to be wedged against the gate. Lord Fa'id called an order. A reserve platoon of 10 knights charged from the side, thrust behind the main body of Ballant horsemen, rode through the foot soldiers, fought into the keep, cut down the gate tenders. Lord Ballant bellowed to Anderson Grimes,
They have one inside. Quick with your cursed demon. If he can help us, let him do so now.
Demon possession is not a matter of an instant, muttered the jinxman. I need time.
You have no time. 10 minutes and we're all dead.
I will do my best. Everard, Everard, come swift.
He hastened into his workroom, donned his demon mask, tossed handful after handful of incense into the brazier. Against one wall stood a great form, black, slit-eyed, noseless. Great white fangs hung from its upper palate. It stood on heavy bent legs, arms reached forward to grasp. Anderson Grimes swallowed a cup of syrup, paced slowly back and forth. A moment passed.
Grimes!
Came Ballant's call from outside.
Grimes!
A voice spoke.
Enter without fear.
Lord Ballant, carrying his ancestral sidearm, entered. He drew back with an involuntary sound.
Grimes!
he whispered.
Grimes is not here, said the voice. I am here. Enter.
Lord Ballant came forward, stiff-legged.
The room was dark, except for the feeble glimmer of the brazier.
Anderson Grimes crouched in a corner, head bowed under his demon mask. The shadows twisted and pulsed with shapes and faces, forms struggling to become solid. The black image seemed to vibrate with life.
Bring in your warriors, said the voice. Bring them in five at a time, bid them look only at the floor until commanded to raise their eyes.
Lord Ballant retreated. There was no sound in the room. A moment passed, then five limp and exhausted warriors filed into the room, eyes low.
Look slowly up, said the voice. Look at the orange fire. Breathe deeply. Then look at me. I am Everid, demon of hate. Look at me. Who am I?
You are Everid, demon of hate, quavered the warriors.
I stand all around you in a dozen forms. I come closer. Where am I?
You are close.
Now I am you. We are together.
There was a sudden quiver of motion. The warriors stood straighter, their faces distorted.
Go forth, said the voice. Go quietly into the court. In a few minutes we march forth to slay.
The five stalked forth. Five more entered. Outside the wall, the Ballant knights had retreated as far as the gate. Within, seven Fa'id knights still survived, and with their backs to the wall held the Ballant warriors away from the gate mechanism. In the Fa'id camp, Husk called to Commandore,
Everid is walking. Bring forth Kirill.
Send the men,
came Commandore's voice, low and harsh.
Send the men to me. I am Kirill.
Within the keep, 20 warriors came marching into the courtyard. Their steps were cautious, tentative, slow. Their faces had lost individuality. They were twisted and distorted, curiously alike.
Bewitched,
whispered the Ballant soldiers, drawing back. The seven Fa'id knights watched with sudden fright, but the 20 warriors, paying them no heed, marched out the gate. The Ballant knights parted. For an instant, there was a lull in the fighting. The 20 sprang like tigers. Their swords glistened, twinkling in water-bright arcs. They crouched, jerked, jumped. Fa'id arms, legs, heads were hewed off. The 20 were cut and battered, but the blows seemed to have no effect. The Fa'id attack faltered, collapsed. The knights, whose armor was no protection against the demoniac swords, retreated. The 20 possessed warriors raced out into the open toward the foot soldiers, running with great strides, slashing and rending. The Fa'id foot soldiers fought for a moment, then they too gave way and turned to flee. From behind Commandori's tent appeared 30 Fa'id warriors, marching stiffly, slowly. Like the Ballant 20, their faces were alike, but between the Everid possessed and the Kirill possessed was the difference between the face of Everid and the face of Kirill. Kirill and Everid fought, using the men as weapons, without fear, retreat, or mercy. Hack, chop, cut. Arms, legs, sundered torsos. Bodies fought headless for moments before collapsing. Only when a body was minced, hacked to bits, did the demoniac vitality depart. Presently there were no more men of Everid, and only 15 men of Kirill. These hopped and limped and tumbled toward the keep where Fa'id knights still held the gate. The Ballant knights met them in despair, knowing that now was the decisive moment. Leaping, leering from chopped faces, slashing from tireless arms, the warriors cut a hole into the iron. The Fa'id knights, roaring victory cries, plunged after. Into the courtyard surged the battle, and now there was no longer doubt of the outcome. Ballant Keep was taken. Back in his tent, Isaac Commandore took a deep breath, shuddered, flung down his demon mask. In the courtyard, the 12 remaining warriors dropped in their tracks, twitched, gasped, gushed blood, and died. Lord Ballant, in the last gallant act of a gallant life, marched forth brandishing his ancestral sidearm. He aimed across the bloody field at Lord Fa'id to pull the trigger. The weapon spewed a brief gout of light. Lord Fa'id's skin prickled and hair rose from his head. The weapon crackled, turned cherry red, and melted. Lord Ballant threw down the weapon, drew his sword, marched forth to challenge Lord Fa'id. Lord Faed, disinclined to unnecessary combat, signaled to his soldiers. A flight of darts ended Lord Balin's life, saving him the discomfort of formal execution. There was no further resistance. The Balint defenders threw down their arms and marched grimly out to kneel before Lord Faed, while inside the keep, the Balint women gave themselves to mourning and grief. 5. Lord Faed had no wish to linger at Balint Keep, for he took no relish in his victories. Inevitably, 1,000 decisions had to be made. 6 of the closest Balint kinsmen were summarily stabbed and the title declared defunct. Others of the clan were offered a choice, an oath of lifelong fealty together with a moderate ransom, or death. Eyes blazing hate, too, chose death and were stabbed. Lord Faed had now achieved his ambition. For over 1,000 years, the keep lords had struggled for power, now one, now another, gaining ascendancy. None before had ever extended his authority across the entire continent, which meant control of the planet, since all other land was either sun-parched rock or eternal ice. Balint Keep had long thwarted Lord Faed's drive to power. Now, success. Total and absolute. It still remained to chastise the lords of Castle Cloud and Gisborne, both of whom, seeing opportunity to overwhelm Lord Faed, had ranged themselves behind Lord Balint. But these were matters that might well be assigned to Hein Huss. Lord Faed, for the first time in his life, felt a trace of uncertainty. Now what? No real adversaries remained. The first folk must be whipped back, but here was no great problem. They were numerous, but no more than savages. He knew that dissatisfaction and controversy would ultimately arise among his kinsmen and allies. Inaction and boredom would breed irritability. Idle minds would calculate the pros and cons of mischief. Even the most loyal would remember the campaigns with nostalgia and long for the excitement, the release, the license of warfare. Somehow he must find means to absorb the energy of so many active and keyed-up men. How and where? This was the problem. The construction of roads? New farmland claimed from the downs? Yearly tournaments at arms? Lord Faed frowned at the inadequacy of his solutions, but his imagination was impoverished by the lack of tradition. The original settlers of Pangborn had been warriors and had brought with them a certain amount of practical rule-of-thumb knowledge, but little else. The tales they passed down the generations described the great spaceships which moved with magic speed and certainty, their miraculous weapons, the wars in the void, but told nothing of human history or civilized achievement. And so Lord Faed, full of power and success, but with no goal toward which to turn his strength, felt more morose and saturnine than ever. He gloomily inspected the spoils from Balint Keep. They were of no great interest to him. Balint's ancestral car was no longer used, but displayed behind a glass case. He inspected the weapon Volcano, but this could not be moved. In any event, it was useless, its magic lost forever. Lord Faed now knew that Lord Balint had ordered it turned against the Faed car, but that it had refused to spew its vaunted fire. Lord Faed saw with disdainful amusement that Volcano had been sadly neglected. Corrosion had pitted the metal. Careless cleaning had twisted the exterior tubing, undoubtedly diminishing the potency of the magic. No such neglect at Faed Keep. Jambart, the weapon tender, cherished Hellmouth with absolute devotion. Elsewhere were other ancient devices, interesting but useless, the same sort of curios that cluttered shelves and cases at Faed Keep. Peculiar, these ancient men, thought Lord Faed, at once so clever, yet so primitive and impractical. Conditions had changed. There had been enormous advances since the Dark Ages 1,600 years ago. For instance, the ancients had used intricate fetishes of metal and glass to communicate with each other. Lord Faed need merely voice his needs. Hein Huss could project his mind 100 miles to see, to hear, to relay Lord Faed's words. The ancients had contrived dozens of such objects, but the old magic had worn away, and they never seemed to function. Lord Balint's sidearm had melted after merely stinging Lord Faed. Imagine a troop armed thus trying to cope with a platoon of demon-possessed warriors. Slaughter of the innocents.
Among the Ballant trove, Lord Faid noted a dozen old books and several reels of microfilm. The books were worthless, page after page of incomprehensible jargon. The microfilm was equally undecipherable. Again, Lord Faid wondered skeptically about the ancients. Clever, of course, but to look at the hard facts, they were a little more advanced than the first folk. Neither had facility with telepathy or voyance or demon command. And the magic of the ancients? Might there not be a great deal of exaggeration in the legends? Volcano, for instance. A joke. Lord Faid wondered about his own Hellmouth. But no. Surely Hellmouth was more trustworthy. Jambart cleaned and polished the weapon daily and washed the entire cupola with vintage wine every month. If human care could induce faithfulness, then Hellmouth was ready to defend Faid Keep. Now there was no longer need for defense. Faid was supreme. Considering the future, Lord Faid made a decision. There should no longer be Keep Lords on Pangborn. He would abolish the appellation. Habitancy of the keeps would gradually be transferred to trusted bailiffs on a yearly basis. The former lords would be moved to comfortable but indefensible manor houses, with the maintenance of private troops forbidden. Naturally, there must be allowed jinxmen, but these would be made accountable to himself, perhaps through some sort of licensing provision. He must discuss the matter with Hindhus. A matter for the future, however. Now he merely wished to settle affairs and return to Faid Keep. There was little more to be done. The surviving Ballant kinsmen he sent to their homes after Huss had impregnated fresh dolls with their essences. Should they default on their ransoms? A twinge of fire, a few stomach cramps would more than set them right. Ballant Keep itself, Lord Faid would have liked to burn. But the material of the ancients was proof to fire. But in order to discourage any new pretenders to the Ballant heritage, Lord Faid ordered all the heirlooms and relics brought forth into the courtyard, and then, one at a time, in order of rank, he bade his men choose. Thus the Ballant wealth was distributed. Even the jinxmen were invited to choose, but they despised the ancient trinkets as works of witless superstition. The lesser spellbinders and apprentices rummaged through the leavings, occasionally finding an overlooked bauble or some anomalous implement. Isaac Commandori was irritated to find Sam Salazar staggering under a load of the ancient books.
"And what is your purpose with these?" he barked.
"Why do you burden yourself with rubbish?" Sam Salazar hung his head. "I have no definite purpose. Undoubtedly there was wisdom, or at least knowledge, among the ancients. Perhaps I can use these symbols of knowledge to sharpen my own understanding." Commandori threw up his hands in disgust. He turned to Hein Huss, who stood nearby.
"First he fancies himself a tree and stands in the mud. Now he thinks to learn jinxmanship through a study of ancient symbols."
Huss shrugged.
"They were men like ourselves, and though limited, they were not entirely obtuse. A certain simian cleverness is required to fabricate these objects."
"Simian cleverness is no substitute for sound jinxmanship," retorted Isaac Commandori. "This is a point hard to overemphasize. I have drummed it into Salazar's head 100 times, and now look at him." Huss grunted noncommittally.
"I fail to understand what he hopes to achieve."
Sam Salazar tried to explain, fumbling for words to express an idea that did not exist. "I thought perhaps to decipher the writing, if only to understand what the ancients thought, and perhaps to learn how to perform one or two of their tricks." Commandori rolled up his eyes.
"What enemy bewitched me when I consented to take you as apprentice? I can cast 20 hoodoos in an hour, more than any of the ancients could achieve in a lifetime."
"Nevertheless," said Sam Salazar, "I noticed that Lord Faid rides in his ancestral car, and that Lord Ballant sought to kill us all with volcano."
"I notice," said Commandore with feral softness, "that my demon Kirill conquered Lord Ballant's volcano, and that riding on my wagon I can outdistance Lord Faid in his car."
Sam Salazar thought better of arguing further. "True, Jinxman Commandori, very true. I stand corrected."
"Then discard that rubbish and make yourself useful. We return to Faid Keep in the morning."
"As you wish, Jinxman Commandori." Sam Salazar threw the books back into the trash. 6. The Ballant clan had been dispersed.
Ballant Keep was despoiled. Lord Faid and his men banqueted somberly in the great hall, tended by silent Ballant servitors. Ballant Keep had been built on the same splendid scale as Faid Keep. The great hall was 100 feet long, 50 feet wide, 50 feet high, paneled in planks sawn from pale native hardwood, rubbed and waxed to a rich honey color. Enormous black beams supported the ceiling. From these hung candelabra, intricate contrivances of green, purple, and blue glass, knotted with ancient but still bright light motes. On the far wall hung portraits of all the lords of Ballant Keep, 105 grave faces in a variety of costumes. Below, a genealogical chart, 10 feet high, detailed the descent of the Ballants and their connections with the other noble clans. Now there was a desolate air to the hall, and the 105 dead faces were meaningless and empty. Lord Faid dined without joy, and cast dour side glances at those of his kinsmen who reveled too gladly. Lord Ballant, he thought, had conducted himself only as he himself might have done under the same circumstances.
Coarse exultation seemed in poor taste, almost as if it were disrespect for Lord Faid himself.
His followers were quick to catch his mood, and the banquet proceeded with greater decorum. The Jinxmen sat apart in a smaller room to the side. Anderson Grimes, erstwhile Ballant head Jinxman, sat beside Hein Huss, trying to put a good face on his defeat. After all, he had performed creditably against 4 powerful adversaries, and there was no cause to feel a diminution of mana. The 5 Jinxmen discussed the battle, while the Cabal men and spellbinders listened respectfully. The conduct of the demon-possessed troops occasioned the most discussion.
Anderson Grimes readily admitted that his conception of Everid was a force absolutely brutal and blunt, terrifying in its indomitable vigor. The other Jinxmen agreed that he undoubtedly succeeded in projecting these qualities. Ein Huss, however, pointed out that Isaac Commandori's Kiro, as cruel and vigorous as Everid, also combined a measure of crafty malice which tended to make the possessed soldier a more effective weapon. Anderson Grimes allowed that this might well be the case, and that, in fact, he had been considering such an augmentation of Everidge's characteristics.
"To my mind," said Huss, "the most effective demon should be swift enough to avoid the strokes of the brute demons, such as Kirill and Everid. I cite my own Daunt as example. A Daunt-possessed warrior can easily destroy a Kirill or an Everid simply through his agility. In an encounter of this sort, the Kirills and Everids presently lose their capacity to terrify, and thus half the effect is lost."
Isaac Commandori pierced Huss with a hot russet glance.
"You state a presumption as if it were fact. I have formulated Kirill with sufficient craft to counter any such displays of speed. I firmly believe Kirill to be the most fearsome of all demons."
"It may well be," rumbled Hein Huss thoughtfully.
He beckoned to a steward, gave instructions. The steward reduced the light a trifle.
"Behold," said Hein Huss, "there is Daunt. He comes to join the banquet."
At the side of the room loomed the tiger-striped Daunt, a creature constructed of resilient metal, with 4 terrible arms and a squat black head, which seemed all gaping jaw.
"Look," came the husky voice of Isaac Commandori. "There is Kirill."
Kirill was rather more humanoid and armed with a cutlass. Daunt spied Kirill. The jaws gaped wider. It sprang to the attack. The battle was a thing of horror. The 2 demons rolled, twisted, bit, frothed, uttered soundless shrieks, tore each other apart. Suddenly, Daunt sprang away, circled Kirill with dizzying speed, faster, faster, became a blur, a wild coruscation of colors that seemed to give off a high-pitched wailing sound, rising higher and higher in pitch. Kirill hacked brutally with his cutlass, then seemed to grow feeble and wan. The light that once had been Daunt blazed white, exploded in a mental shriek. Kirill was gone, and Isaac Commandori lay moaning.
Hein Huss drew a deep breath, wiped his face, looked about him with a complacent grin. The entire company sat rigid as stones, staring, all except the apprentice Sam Salazar, who met Hein Huss's glance with a cheerful smile.
"So,"
growled Huss, panting from his exertion,
You consider yourself superior to the illusion? You sit and smirk at one of Hein Huss's best efforts.
No, no, cried Sam Salazar. I mean no disrespect. I want to learn, so I watched you rather than the demons. What could they teach me? Nothing.
Ah, said Huss, mollified. And what did you learn?
Likewise, nothing, said Sam Salazar. But at least I do not sit like a fish.
Commandore's voice came soft but crackling with wrath.
You see in me the resemblance to a fish.
I accept you, Jinxman Commandore, naturally, Sam Salazar explained.
Please go to my cabinet, Apprentice Salazar, and fetch me the doll that is your likeness. The steward will bring a basin of water, and we shall have some sport. With your knowledge of fish, you perhaps can breathe under water. If not, you may suffocate.
I prefer not, Jinxman Commandore, said Sam Salazar. In fact, with your permission, I now resign your service.
Commandore motioned to one of his cabal men.
Fetch me the Salazar doll. Since he is no longer my apprentice, it is likely indeed that he will suffocate.
Come now, Commandore, said Hein Huss gruffly. Do not torment the lad. He is innocent and a trifle addled. Let this be an occasion of placidity and ease.
Certainly, Hein Huss, said Commandore. Why not? There is ample time in which to discipline this upstart.
Jinxman Huss, said Sam Salazar, since I am now relieved of my duties to Jinxman Commandore, perhaps you will accept me into your service.
Hein Huss made a noise of vast distaste.
You are not my responsibility.
There are many futures, Hein Huss, said Sam Salazar. You have said as much yourself.
Hein Huss looked at Sam Salazar with his water-clear eyes.
Yes, there are many futures. And I think that tonight sees the full amplitude of jinxmanship. I think that never again will such power and skill gather at the same table. We shall die one by one, and there shall be none to fill our shoes. Yes, Sam Salazar, I will take you as apprentice. Isaac Commandore, do you hear? This youth is now of my company.
I must be compensated, growled Commandore.
You have coveted my doll of Tharin Faid, the only one in existence. It is yours.
Aha!
Cried Isaac Commandore, leaping to his feet.
Hein Huss, I salute you. You are generous indeed. I thank you and accept.
Hein Huss motioned to Sam Salazar.
Move your effects to my wagon. Do not show your face again tonight.
Sam Salazar bowed with dignity and departed the hall. The banquet continued, but now something of melancholy filled the room. Presently a messenger from Lord Faid came to warn all to bed, for the party returned to Faid Keep at dawn. 7. The victorious Faid troops gathered on the heath before Ballant Keep. As a parting gesture, Lord Faid ordered the great gate torn off the hinges so that ingress could never again be denied him. But even after 1,600 years, the hinges were proof to all the force the horses could muster, and the gates remained in place. Lord Faid accepted the fact with good grace and bade farewell to his cousin Renfroy, whom he had appointed bailiff. He climbed into his car, settled himself, snapped the switch. The car groaned and moved forward. Behind came the knights and the foot soldiers, then the baggage train, laden with booty, and finally the wagons of the jinxmen. 3 hours the column marched across the mossy downs. Ballant Keep dwindled behind. Ahead appeared north and south Wildwood, darkening all the sweep of the western horizon. Where once the break had existed, the first folk's new planting showed a smudge lower and less intense than the old woodlands. 2 miles from the woodlands, Lord Faid called a halt and signaled up his knights. Hein Huss laboriously dismounted from his wagon, came forward.
In the event of resistance, Lord Faid told the knights, do not be tempted into the forest. Stay with the column and at all times be on your guard against traps.
Hein Huss spoke.
You wish me to parley with the first folk once more?
No, said Lord Faid. It is ridiculous that I must ask permission of savages to ride over my own land. We return as we came. If they interfere, so much the worse for them.
You are rash,
said Huss with simple candor. Lord Faid glanced down at him with black eyebrows raised.
What damage can they do if we avoid their traps? Blow foam at us?
It is not my place to advise or to warn, said Hein Huss. However, I point out that they exhibit a confidence which does not come from conscious weakness. Also, that they carried tubes, apparently hollow grasswood shoots, which imply missiles.
Lord Faid nodded.
No doubt. However, the knights wear armor. The soldiers carry bucklers. It is not fit that I, Lord Faid of Faid Keep, choose my path to suit the whims of the first folk. This must be made clear, even if the exercise involves a dozen or so first folk corpses.
Since I am not a fighting man, remarked Hein Huss, I will keep well to the rear and pass only when the way is secure.
As you wish.
Lord Faid pulled down the visor of his helmet.
Forward!
The column moved toward the forest, along the previous track, which showed plain across the moss. Lord Faid rode in the lead, flanked by his brother, Gethwin Faid, and his cousin, Mauve Dermot Faid. A half mile passed, and another. The forest was only a mile distant. Overhead, the great sun rode at zenith. Brightness and heat poured down. The air carried the oily scent of thorn and tarbush. The column moved on more slowly. The only sounds, the clanking of armor, the muffled thud of hooves in the moss, the squeal of wagon wheels. Lord Faid rose up in his car, watching for any sign of hostile preparation. A half mile from the planting, the forms of the first folk, waiting in the shade along the forest's verge, became visible. Lord Faid ignored them, held a steady pace along the track they had traveled before. The half mile became a quarter mile. Lord Faid turned to order the troops into single file and was just in time to see a hole suddenly open into the moss and his brother, Gethwin Faid, drop from sight. There was a rattle, a thud, the howling of the impaled horse, Gethwin's wild calls as the horse kicked and crushed him into the stakes. Mauve Dermot Faid, riding beside Gethwin, could not control his own horse, which leaped aside from the pit and blundered upon a trigger. Up from the moss burst a tree trunk studded with foot-long thorns. It snapped, quick as a scorpion's tail. The thorns punctured Mauve Dermot Faid's armor, his chest, and whisked him from his horse to carry him suspended, writhing and screaming. The tip of the scythe pounded into Lord Faid's car, splintered against the hull. The car swung groaning through the air. Lord Faid clutched at the windscreen to prevent himself from falling. The column halted. Several men ran to the pit, but Gethwin Faid lay 20 feet below, crushed under his horse. Others took Mauve Dermot Faid down from the swaying scythe, but he too was dead. Lord Faid's skin tingled with a goose flesh of hate and rage. He looked toward the forest. The first folk stood motionless. He beckoned to Bernard, sergeant of the foot soldiers.
2 men with lances to try out the ground ahead. All others ready with darts. At my signal, spit the devils.
2 men came forward, and marching before Lord Faid's car, probed at the ground. Lord Faid settled in his seat.
Forward!
The column moved slowly toward the forest, every man tense and ready. The lances of the 2 men in the vanguard presently broke through the moss to disclose a nettle trap, a pit lined with nettles, each frond ripe with globes of acid. Carefully they probed out a path to the side, and the column filed around, each man walking in the other's tracks. At Lord Faid's side now rode his 2 nephews, Scolford and Edwin.
Notice, said Lord Faid in a voice harsh and tight, these traps were laid since our last passage, an act of malice.
But why did they guide us through before?
Lord Faid smiled bitterly.
They were willing that we should die at Ballant Keep, but we have disappointed them.
Notice they carry tubes, said Scolford. Blowguns, possibly, suggested Edwin.
Scolford disagreed.
They cannot blow through their foam vents.
No doubt we shall soon learn, said Lord Faid.
He rose in his seat, called to the rear.
Ready with the darts.
The soldiers raised their crossbows. The column advanced slowly, now only 100 yards from the planting. The white shapes of the first folk moved uneasily at the forest's edges. Several of them raised their tubes, seemed to sight along the length. They twitched their great hands. One of the tubes was pointed toward Lord Faid. He saw a small black object leave the opening, flit forward, gathering speed. He heard a hum, waxing to a rasping, clicking flutter. He ducked behind the windscreen. The projectile swooped in pursuit, struck the windscreen like a thrown stone. It fell crippled upon the forward deck of the car. A heavy, black insect, like a wasp, its broken proboscis oozing ochre liquid. Horny wings beating feebly, eyes like dumbbells fixed on Lord Faid. With his mailed fist, he crushed the creature. Behind him, other wasps struck knights and men. Korax Faid Vataro took the prong through his visor into the eye, but the armor of the other knights defeated the wasps. The foot soldiers, however, lacked protection. The wasps half buried themselves in flesh. The soldiers called out in pain, clawed away the wasps, squeezed the wounds. Korax Faid Vataro toppled from his horse, ran blindly out over the heath, and after 50 feet fell into a trap. The stricken soldiers began to twitch, then fell on the moss, thrashed, leaped up to run with flapping arms, threw themselves in wild somersaults, foaming and thrashing. In the forest, the first folk raised their tubes again. Lord Faid bellowed,
"Spit the creatures! Bowmen, launch your darts!"
There came the twang of crossbows. Darts snapped at the quiet white shapes. A few staggered and wandered aimlessly away. Most, however, plucked out the darts, or ignored them. They took capsules from small sacks, put them to the end of their tubes.
"Beware the wasps!" cried Lord Faid. "Strike with your bucklers! Kill the cursed things in flight!"
The rasp of horny wings came again. Certain of the soldiers found courage enough to follow Lord Faid's orders and battered down the wasps. Others struck home as before. Behind came another flight. The column became a tangle of struggling, crouching men.
"Footmen, retreat!" called Lord Faid furiously. "Footmen, back! Knights, to me!"
The soldiers fled back along the track, taking refuge behind the baggage wagons. 30 of their number lay dying or dead on the moss. Lord Faid cried out to his knights in a voice like a bugle,
"Dismount, follow slow after me. Turn your helmets. Keep the wasps from your eyes. One step at a time behind the car. Edwin, into the car beside me. Test the footing with your lance. Once in the forest, there are no traps. Then attack."
The knights formed themselves into a line behind the car. Lord Faid drove slowly forward, his kinsman Edwin prodding the ground ahead. The first folk sent out 12 more wasps, which dashed themselves vainly against the armor. Then there was silence, cessation of sound activity. The first folk watched impassively as the knights approached, step by step. Edwin's lance found a trap. The column moved to the side. Another trap, and the column was diverted from the planting toward the forest. Step by step, yard by yard, another trap, another detour. And now the column was only 100 feet from the forest. A trap to the left, a trap to the right. The safe path led directly toward an enormous, heavy, branched tree. 70 feet, 50 feet. Then Lord Faid drew his sword.
"Prepare to charge! Kill till your arms tire!"
From the forest came a crackling sound. The branches of the great tree trembled and swayed. The knights stared, for a moment frozen into place. The tree toppled forward. The knights madly tried to flee, to the rear, to the sides. Traps opened. The knights dropped upon sharp stakes. The tree fell. Boughs cracked, armored bodies like nuts. There was the hoarse yelling of pinned men, screams from the traps, the crackling subsidence of breaking branches. Lord Faid had been battered down into the car, and the car had been pressed groaning into the moss. His first instinctive act was to press the switch to rest position. Then he staggered erect, clambered up through the boughs. A pale, unhuman face peered at him. He swung his fist, crushed the faceted eyeballs, and, roaring with rage, scrambled through the branches. Others of his knights were working themselves free, although almost a third were either crushed or impaled. The first folk came scrambling forward, armed with enormous thorns, long as swords. But now Lord Faid could reach them at close quarters. Hissing with vindictive joy, he sprang into their midst, swinging his sword with both hands, as if demon-possessed.
The surviving knights joined him, and the ground became littered with dismembered first folk. They drew back slowly, without excitement. Lord Faid reluctantly called back his knights.
We must succor those still pinned, as many as still are alive.
As well as possible, branches were cut away, injured knights drawn forth. In some cases, the soft moss had cushioned the impact of the tree. 6 knights were dead, another 4 crushed beyond hope of recovery. To these, Lord Faid himself gave the coup de grace. 10 minutes further hacking and chopping freed Lord Faid's car, while the first folk watched incuriously from the forest. The knights wished to charge once more, but Lord Faid ordered retreat. Without interference, they returned the way they had come, back to the baggage train. Lord Faid ordered a muster. Of the original war party, less than 2/3 remained. Lord Faid shook his head bitterly. Galling to think how easily he had been led into a trap. He swung on his heel, strode to the rear of the column, to the wagons of the magicians. The jinxmen sat around a small fire, drinking tea.
Which of you will hoodoo these white forest vermin? I want them dead. Stricken with sickness, cramps, blindness, the most painful afflictions you can contrive.
There was general silence. The jinxmen sipped their tea.
Well,
demanded Lord Faid,
have you no answer? Do I not make myself plain?
Hein Huss cleared his throat, spat into the blaze.
Your wishes are plain. Unfortunately, we cannot hoodoo the first folk. And why? There are technical reasons.
Lord Faid knew the futility of argument.
Must we slink home around the forest? If you cannot hoodoo the first folk, then bring out your demons. I will march on the forest and chop out a path with my sword. It is not for me to suggest tactics, grumbled Hein Huss. Go on, speak. I will listen. A suggestion has been put to me, which I will pass to you. Neither I nor the other jinxmen associate ourselves with it, since it recommends the crudest of physical principles. I await the suggestion, said Lord Faid. It is merely this. One of my apprentices tampered with your car, as you may remember. Yes, and I will see he gets the hiding he deserves. By some freak, he caused the car to rise high into the air. The suggestion is this, that we load the car with as much oil as the baggage train affords, that we send the car aloft and let it drift over the planting. At a suitable moment, the occupant of the car will pour the oil over the trees, then hurl down a torch. The forest will burn. The first folk will be at least discomfited. At best, a large number will be destroyed.
Lord Faid slapped his hands together.
Excellent! Quickly to work!
He called a dozen soldiers, gave them orders. 4 kegs of cooking oil, 3 buckets of pitch, 6 demijohns of spirit were brought and lifted into the car. The engines grated and protested, and the car sagged almost to the moss. Lord Faid shook his head sadly.
A rude use of the relic, but all in good purpose. Now, where is that apprentice? He must indicate which switches and which buttons he turned. I suggest, said Hein Huss, that Sam Salazar be sent up with the car.
Lord Faid looked sidewise at Sam Salazar's round, bland countenance.
An efficient hand is needed, a seasoned judgment. I wonder if he can be trusted. I would think so, said Hein Huss. Inasmuch as it was Sam Salazar who evolved the scheme in the first place. Very well. In with you, apprentice. Treat my car with reverence. The wind blows away from us. Fire this edge of the forest in as long a strip as you can manage. The torch, where is the torch?
The torch was brought and secured to the side of the car. One more matter, said Sam Salazar. I would like to borrow the armor of some obliging knight to protect myself from the wasps. Otherwise...
Armor! Bawled Lord Faid. Bring armor!
At last, fully accoutred and with visor down, Sam Salazar climbed into the car. He seated himself, peered intently at the buttons and switches. In truth, he was not precisely certain as to which he had manipulated before. He considered, reached forward,
pushed, turned. The motors roared and screamed. The car shuddered, sluggishly rose into the air. Higher, higher, 20 feet, 40 feet, 60 feet, 100, 200. The wind eased the car toward the forest. In the shade, the first folk watched. Several of them raised tubes, opened the shutters. The onlookers saw wasps dart through the air to dash against Sam Salazar's armor. The car drifted over the trees. Sam Salazar began ladling out the oil. Below, the first folk stirred uneasily. The wind carried the car too far over the forest. Sam Salazar worked the controls, succeeded in guiding himself back. One keg was empty, and another. He tossed them out, pleasantly emptied the remaining two, and the buckets of pitch. He soaked a rag in spirit, ignited it, threw it over the side, poured the spirit after. The flaming rag fell into leaves. A crackle. Fire blazed and sprang. The car now floated at a height of 500 feet. Salazar poured over the remaining spirits, dropped the demijohns, guided the car back over the heath, and, fumbling nervously with the controls, dropped the car in a series of swoops back to the moss. Lord Faid sprang forward, clapped him on the shoulder. "Excellently done! The forest blazes like tinder!" The men of Faid Keep stood back, rejoicing to see the flames soar and lick. The first folk scurried back from the heat, waving their arms. Foam of a peculiar purple color issued from their vents as they ran. Small, useless puffs discharged as if by accident or through excitement. The flames ate through first the forest, then spread into the new planting, leaping through the leaves.
"Prepare to march," called Lord Faid. "We pass directly behind the flames before the first folk return."
Off in the forest, the first folk perched in the trees, blowing out foam in great puffs and billows, building a wall of insulation. The flames had eaten half across the new planting, leaving behind smoldering saplings.
"Forward! Briskly!"
The column moved ahead. Coughing in the smoke, eyes smarting, they passed under still-blazing trees and came out on the western downs. Slowly the column moved forward, led by a pair of soldiers prodding the moss with the lances. Behind followed Lord Faid with the knights. Then came the foot soldiers, then the rumbling baggage train, and finally the 6 wagons of the Jinxmen. A thump, a creak, a snap. A scythe had broken up from the moss. The soldiers in the lead dropped flat. The scythe whipped past, a foot from Lord Faid's face. At the same time, a plaintive cry came from the rear guard.
"They pursue! The first folk come!"
Lord Faid turned to inspect the new threat. A clot of first folk, 200 or more, came across the moss, moving without haste or urgency. Some carried wasp tubes, others thorn rapiers. Lord Faid looked ahead. Another 100 yards should bring the army out upon safe ground. Then he could deploy and maneuver.
"Forward!"
The column proceeded, the baggage train and the Jinxmen's wagons pressing close up against the soldiers. Behind and to one side came the first folk, moving casually and easily. At last, Lord Faid judged they had reached secure ground.
"Forward now! Bring the wagons out! Hurry now!"
The troops needed no urging. They trotted out over the heath, the wagons trundling after. Lord Faid ordered the wagons into a close double line, stationed the soldiers between, with the horses behind them protected from the wasps. The knights, now dismounted, waited in front. The first folk came listlessly, formlessly forward. Blank white faces stared. Huge hands grasped tubes and thorns. Traces of the purplish foam showed at the lips of their underarm orifices. Lord Faid walked along the line of knights.
"Swords ready. Allow them as close as they care to come. Then a quick charge."
He motioned to the foot soldiers.
"Choose a target."
A volley of darts whistled overhead to plunge into white bodies. With chisel-bladed fingers, the first folk plucked them out, discarded them with no evidence of vexation. One or two staggered, wandered confusedly across the line of approach. Others raised their tubes, withdrew the shutter. Out flew the insects, horny wings rasping, prongs thrust forward. Across the moss they flickered to crush themselves against the armor of the knights, to drop to the ground, to be stamped upon. The soldiers cranked their crossbows back into tension, discharged another flight of darts, caused several more first folk casualties. The first folk spread into a long line surrounding the Faid troops.
Lord Faid shifted half his knights to the other side of the wagons.
The first folk wandered closer.
Lord Faid called for a charge. The knights stepped smartly forward, swords swinging. The first folk advanced a few more steps, then stopped short. The flaps of skin at their backs swelled, pulsed. White foam gushed through their vents. Clouds and billows rose up around them. The knights halted uncertainly, prodding and slashing into the foam, but finding nothing. The foam piled higher, rolling in and forward, pushing the knights back toward the wagons. They looked questioningly toward Lord Faid.
Lord Faid waved his sword. Cut through to the other side! Forward!
Slashing two-handed with his sword, he sprang into the foam. He struck something solid, hacked blindly at it, pushed forward. Then his legs were seized. He was upended and fell with a spine-rattling jar. Now he felt the grate of a thorn searching his armor. It found a crevice under his corselet and pierced him. Cursing, he raised on his hands and knees and plunged blindly forward. Enormous, hard hands grasped him. Heavy forms fell on his shoulders. He tried to breathe, but the foam clogged his visor. He began to smother. Staggering to his feet, he half ran, half fell out into the open air, carrying two of the first folk with him. He had lost his sword, but managed to draw his dagger. The first folk released him and stepped back into the foam. Lord Faid sprang to his feet. Inside the foam came the sounds of combat. Some of his knights burst into the open, others called for help. Lord Faid motioned to the knights,
"Back within! The devils slaughter our kinsmen! In and on to the center!"
He took a deep breath. Seizing his dagger, he thrust himself back into the foam. A flurry of shapes came at him. He pounded with his fists, cut with his dagger, stumbled over a mass of living tissue. He kicked the softness and stepped on metal. Bending, he grasped a leg, but found it limp and dead. First folk were on his back. Another thorn found its mark. He groaned and thrust himself forward and once again fell out into the open air. A scant 50 of his knights had won back into the central clearing. Lord Faid cried out,
"To the center! Mount your horses!"
Abandoning his car, he himself vaulted into a saddle. The foam boiled and billowed closer. Lord Faid waved his arm.
"Forward all! At a gallop! After us, the wagons! Out into the open!"
They charged, thrusting the frightened horses into the foam. There was white blindness, the feel of forms underneath, then the open air once again. Behind came the wagons and the foot soldiers, running along the channel cut by the wagons. All won free. All but the knights who had fallen under the foam. 200 yards from the great white clot of foam, Lord Faid halted, turned, looked back. He raised his fist, shook it in a passion.
"My knights, my car, my honor! I'll burn your forests, I'll drive you into the sea. There'll be no peace till all are dead."
He swung around. "Come," he called bitterly to the remnants of his war party.
"We have been defeated. We retreat to Faid Keep."
8. Faid Keep, like Ballant Keep, was constructed of a black, glossy substance, half metal, half stone, impervious to heat, force, and radiation. A parasol roof, designed to ward off hostile energy, rested on 5 squat outer towers, connected by walls almost as high as the lip of the overhanging roof. The homecoming banquet was quiet and morose. The soldiers and knights ate lightly and drank much, but instead of becoming merry, lapsed into gloom. Lord Faid, overcome by emotion, jumped to his feet.
"Everyone sits silent, aching with rage. I feel no differently. We shall take revenge. We shall put the forests to the torch. The cursed white savages will smother and burn. Drink now with good cheer. Not a moment will be wasted, but we must be ready. It is no more than idiocy to attack as before. Tonight I take counsel with the Jinxmen, and we will start a program of affliction."
The soldiers and knights rose to their feet, raised their cups, and drank a somber toast. Lord Faid bowed and left the hall. He went to his private trophy room. On the walls hung escutcheons, memorials, death masks, clusters of swords like many-petaled flowers, a rack of sidearms, energy pistols, electric stilettos, a portrait of the original Faid, an ancient spacefarer's uniform, and a treasured, almost unique photograph of the great ship that had brought the first Faid to Pangborn. Lord Faid studied the ancient face for several moments,
then summoned a servant.
Ask the head jinxman to attend me.
Hein Huss presently stumped into the room. Lord Faid turned away from the portrait, seated himself, motioned to Hein Huss to do likewise.
What of the keep lords?
He asked.
How do they regard the setback at the hands of the first folk?
There are various reactions, said Hein Huss. At Boghoten, Candlewade, and Hava, there is distress and anger.
Lord Faid nodded.
These are my kinsmen. At Gisborne, Greymar, Castle Cloud, and Alder, there is satisfaction, veiled calculation.
To be expected, muttered Lord Faid. These lords must be humbled. In spite of oaths and undertakings, they still think rebellion.
At Starholm, Julian DeRay, and O'Call, I read surprise at the abilities of the first folk, but in the main, disinterest.
Lord Faid nodded sourly.
Well enough. There is no actual rebellion in prospect. We are free to concentrate on the first folk. I will tell you what is in my mind. You report that new plantings are in progress between Wildwood, Old Forest, Sarrow Copse, and elsewhere, possibly with the intent of surrounding Faid Keep.
He looked inquiringly at Hein Huss, but no comment was forthcoming. Lord Faid continued.
Possibly we have underestimated the cunning of the savages. They seem capable of forming plans and acting with almost human persistence. Or I should say, more than human persistence, for it appears that after 1,600 years, they still consider us invaders and hope to exterminate us.
That is my own conclusion, said Hein Huss.
We must take steps to strike first. I consider this a matter for the jinxmen. We gain no honor dodging wasps, falling into traps, or groping through foam. It is a needless waste of lives. Therefore, I want you to assemble your jinxmen, cabalmen, and spellbinders. I want you to formulate your most potent hoodoos.
Impossible.
Lord Faid's black eyebrows rose high.
Impossible?
Hein Huss seemed vaguely uncomfortable.
I read the wonder in your mind. You suspect me of disinterest, irresponsibility. Not true. If the first folk defeat you, we suffer likewise.
Exactly, said Lord Faid dryly. You will starve.
Nevertheless, the jinxmen cannot help you.
He hoisted himself to his feet, started for the door.
Sit, said Lord Faid. It is necessary to pursue this matter.
Hein Huss looked around with his bland, water-clear eyes. Lord Faid met his gaze. Hein Huss sighed deeply.
I see I must ignore the precepts of my trade, break the habits of a lifetime. I must explain.
He took his bulk to the wall, fingered the sidearms and the rack, studied the portrait of the ancestral Faid.
These miracle workers of the old times, unfortunately we cannot use their magic. Notice the bulk of the spaceship, as heavy as Faid Keep.
He turned his gaze on the table, teleported a candelabra 2 or 3 inches.
With considerably less effort, they gave that spaceship enormous velocity, using ideas and forces they knew to be imaginary and irrational. We have advanced since then, of course. We no longer employ mysteries, arcane constructions, wild, non-human forces. We are rational and practical. But we cannot achieve the effects of the ancient magicians.
Lord Faid watched Hein Huss with saturnine eyes. Hein Huss gave his deep, rumbling laugh.
You think that I wish to distract you with talk? No, this is not the case. I am preparing to enlighten you.
He returned to his seat, lowered his bulk with a groan.
Now I must talk at length, to which I am not accustomed. But you must be given to understand what we jinxmen can do and what we cannot do. First, unlike the ancient magicians, we are practical men. Naturally, there is difference in our abilities. The best jinxman combines great telepathic facility, implacable personal force, and intimate knowledge of his fellow humans. He knows their acts, motives, desires, and fears. He understands the symbols that most vigorously represent these qualities. Jinxmanship, in the main, is drudgery, dangerous, difficult, and unromantic, with no mystery except that which we employ to confuse our enemies.
Einhus glanced at Lord Faid to encounter the same saturnine gaze.
I still have told you nothing. I still have spent many words talking around my inability to confound the first folk. Patience.
Speak on, said Lord Faid.
Listen, then. What happens when I hoodoo a man? First, I must enter into his mind telepathically. There are three operational levels, the conscious, the unconscious, the cellular. The most effective jinxing is done if all three levels are influenced. I feel into my victim. I learn as much as possible, supplementing my previous knowledge of him, which is part of my stock in trade. I take up his doll, which carries his traces. The doll is highly useful, but not indispensable. It serves as a focus for my attention. It acts as a pattern or a guide as I fix upon the mind of the victim, and he is bound by his own telepathic capacity to the doll, which bears his traces. So, now, man and doll are identified in my mind and at one or more levels in the victim's mind. Whatever happens to the doll, the victim feels to be happening to himself. There is no more too simple hoodooing than that, from the standpoint of the jinxmen. But, naturally, the victims differ greatly. Susceptibility is the key idea here. Some men are more susceptible than others. Fear and conviction breed susceptibility. As a jinxman succeeds, he becomes ever more feared, and consequently, the more efficacious he becomes. The process is self-generative. Demon possession is a similar technique. Susceptibility is again essential. Again, conviction creates susceptibility. It is easiest and most dramatic when the characteristics of the demon are well known, as in the case of Commandaris Kirill. For this reason, demons can be exchanged or traded among jinxmen. The commodity actually traded is public acceptance and familiarity with the demon.
Demons, then, do not actually exist? Inquired Lord Faid half-incredulously.
Einhus grinned vastly, showing enormous yellow teeth.
Telepathy works through a superstratum. Who knows what is created in this superstratum? Maybe the demons live on after they have been conceived. Maybe they now are real. This, of course, is speculation, which we jinxmen shun. So much for demons. So much for the lesser techniques of jinxmanship. I have explained sufficient to serve as background to the present situation.
Excellent, said Lord Faid. Continue.
The question, then, is, how does one cast a hoodoo into a creature of an alien race?
He looked inquiringly at Lord Faid.
Can you tell me?
I? Asked Lord Faid, surprised. No.
The method is basically the same as in the hoodooing of men. It is necessary to make the creature believe in every cell of his being that he suffers or dies. This is where the problems begin to arise. Does the creature think? That is to say, does he arrange the processes of his life in the same manner as men? This is a very important distinction. Certain creatures of the universe use methods other than the human nerve node system to control their environments. We call the human system intelligence, a word which properly should be restricted to human activity. Other creatures use different agencies, different systems, arriving sometimes at similar ends. To bring home these generalities, I cannot hope to merge my mind with a corresponding capacity in the first folk. The key will not fit the lock, at least not altogether. Once or twice, when I watched the first folk trading with men at Forest Market, I felt occasional weak significances. This implies that the first folk mentality creates something similar to human telepathic impulses. Nevertheless, there is no real sympathy between the two races. This is the first and the least difficulty. If I were able to make complete telepathic contact, what then? The creatures are different from us. They have no words for fear, hate, rage, pain, bravery, cowardice. One may deduce that they do not feel these emotions. Undoubtedly, they know other sensations, possibly as meaningful. Whatever these may be, they are unknown to me, and therefore I cannot either form or project symbols for these sensations.
Lord Faid stirred impatiently.
In short, you tell me that you cannot efficiently enter these creatures' minds, and that if you could, you do not know what influences you could plant there to do them harm.
Succinct, agreed Hindhus. Substantially accurate.
Lord Faid rose to his feet.
In that case, you must repair these deficiencies. You must learn to telepathize with the first folk. You must find what influences will harm them as quickly as possible.
Hindhus stared reproachfully at Lord Faid.
But I have gone to great lengths to explain the difficulties involved. To hoodoo the first folk is a monumental task. It would be necessary to enter Wildwood, to live with the first folk, to become one of them, as my apprentice thought to become a tree. Even then, an effective hoodoo is improbable. The first folk must be susceptible to conviction, otherwise there would be no bite to the hoodoo. I could guarantee no success. I would predict failure. No other jinxman would dare tell you this. No other would risk his mana. I dare because I am Hindhus, with life behind me.
Nevertheless, we must attempt every weapon at hand, said Lord Faid in a dry voice. I cannot risk my knights, my kinsmen, my soldiers against these pallid half-creatures. What a waste of good flesh and blood to be stuck by a poison insect. You must go to Wildwood. You must learn how to hoodoo the first folk.
Hindhus heaved himself erect. His great round face was stony. His eyes were like bits of water-worn glass.
It is likewise a waste to go on a fool's errand. I am no fool, and I will not undertake a hoodoo which is futile from the beginning.
In that case, said Lord Faid, I will find someone else.
He went to the door, summoned a servant.
Bring Isaac Commandori here.
Hindhus lowered his bulk into the chair.
I will remain during the interview. With your permission.
As you wish.
Isaac Commandori appeared in the doorway, tall, loosely articulated, head hanging forward. He darted a glance of swift appraisal at Lord Faid, at Hindhus, then stepped into the room. Lord Faid crisply explained his desires.
Hindhus refuses to undertake the mission. Therefore I call on you.
Isaac Commandori calculated. The pattern of his thinking was clear. He possibly could gain much mana. There was small risk of diminution, for had not Hindhus already dodged away from the project? Commandori nodded.
Hindhus has made clear the difficulties. Only a very clever and very lucky jinxman can hope to succeed. But I accept the challenge. I will go.
Good,
said Hindhus.
I will go, too.
Isaac Commandore darted him a sudden, hot glance.
I wish only to observe. To Isaac Commandore goes the responsibility and whatever credit may ensue.
Very well, said Commandore presently. I welcome your company. Tomorrow morning we leave. I go to order our wagon.
Late in the evening, apprentice Sam Salazar came to Hindhus, where he sat brooding in his workroom.
What do you wish?
Growled Huss.
I have a request to make of you, Head Jinxman Huss.
Head Jinxman in name only, grumbled Hindhus. Isaac Commandori is about to assume my position.
Sam Salazar blinked, laughed uncertainly. Hindhus fixed wintry pale eyes on him.
What do you wish?
I have heard that you go on an expedition to Wildwood to study the first folk.
True, true. What then?
Surely they will now attack all men?
Einhus shrugged. At forest market they trade with men. At forest market men have always entered the forest. Perhaps there will be change, perhaps not.
I would go with you, if I may, said Sam Salazar.
This is no mission for apprentices.
An apprentice must take every opportunity to learn, said Sam Salazar. Also, you will need extra hands to set up tents, to load and unload cabinets, to cook, to fetch water, and other such matters.
Your argument is convincing, said Heinhus. We depart at dawn. Be on hand.
9. As the sun lifted over the heath, the jinxmen departed Faid Keep. The high-wheeled wagon creaked north over the moss, Heinhus and Isaac Commandore riding the front seat, Sam Salazar with his legs hanging over the tail. The wagon rose and fell with the dips and mounds of the moss, wheels wobbling, and presently passed out of sight behind Skywatcher's Hill. 5 days later, an hour before sunset, the wagon reappeared. As before, Heinhus and Isaac Commandore rode the front seat, with Sam Salazar perched behind. They approached the keep, and without giving so much as a sign or a nod, drove through the gate into the courtyard. Isaac Commandore unfolded his long legs, stepped to the ground like a spider. Heinhus lowered himself with a grunt. Both went to their quarters, while Sam Salazar led the wagon to the Jinxman's warehouse. Somewhat later, Isaac Commandore presented himself to Lord Faid, who had been waiting in his trophy room, forced to a show of indifference through considerations of position, dignity, and protocol. Isaac Commandore stood in the doorway, grinning like a fox. Lord Faid eyed him with sour dislike, waiting for Commandore to speak. Heinhus might have stationed himself an entire day, eyes placidly fixed on Lord Faid, awaiting the first word. Isaac Commandore lacked the absolute serenity. He came a step forward.
I have returned from Wildwood.
With what results?
I believe that it is possible to hoodoo the first folk.
Heinhus spoke from behind Commandore. I believe that such an undertaking, if feasible, would be useless, irresponsible, and possibly dangerous.
He lumbered forward. Isaac Commandore's eyes glowed hot red-brown. He turned back to Lord Faid.
You ordered me forth on a mission. I will render a report.
Seat yourselves. I will listen.
Isaac Commandore, nominal head of the expedition, spoke.
We rode along the riverbank to Forest Market. Here was no sign of disorder or of hostility. 100 first folk traded timber, planks, posts, and poles for knife blades, iron wire, and copper pots. When they returned to their barge, we followed them aboard, wagon, horses, and all. They showed no surprise.
Surprise, said Heinhus heavily, is an emotion of which they have no knowledge.
Isaac Commandore glared briefly.
We spoke to the barge tenders, explaining that we wished to visit the interior of Wildwood. We asked if the first folk would try to kill us to prevent us from entering the forest. They professed indifference as to either our well-being or our destruction. This was by no means a guarantee of safe conduct. However, we accepted it as such and remained aboard the barge.
He spoke on with occasional emendations from Heinhus. They had proceeded up the river into the forest, the first folk poling against the slow current. Presently they put away the poles. Nevertheless, the barge moved as before. The mystified Jinxmen discussed the possibility of teleportation, or symbological force, and wondered if the first folk had developed jinxing techniques unknown to men. Sam Salazar, however, noticed that 4 enormous water beetles, each 12 feet long, with oil-black carapaces and blunt heads, had risen from the riverbed and pushed the barge from behind, apparently without direction or command. The first folk stood at the bow, turning the nose of the barge this way or that to follow the winding of the river. They ignored the Jinxmen and Sam Salazar, as if they did not exist. The beetles swam tirelessly. The barge moved for 4 hours as fast as a man could walk. Occasionally, first folk peered from the forest shadows, but none showed interest or concern in the barge's unusual cargo. By mid-afternoon, the river widened,
broke into many channels and became a marsh. A few minutes later, the barge floated out into the open water of a small lake. Along the shore, behind the first line of trees, appeared a large settlement. The Jinxmen were interested and surprised. It had always been assumed that the first folk wandered at random through the forest, as they had originally lived in the moss of the downs. The barge grounded. The first folk walked ashore. The men followed with the horses and wagon. Their immediate impressions were of swarming numbers, of slow but incessant activity, and they were attacked by an overpoweringly evil smell. Ignoring the stench, the men brought the wagon in from the shore, paused to take stock of what they saw. The settlement appeared to be a center of many diverse activities. The trees had been stripped of lower branches and supported blocks of hardened foam, 300 feet long, 50 feet high, 20 feet thick, with a space of a man's height intervening between the underside of the foam and the ground. There were a dozen of these blocks, apparently of cellular construction. Certain of the cells had broken open and seethed with small, white, fish-like creatures. The first folk young. Below the blocks, masses of first folk engaged in various occupations, in the main unfamiliar to the Jinxmen. Leaving the wagon in the care of Sam Salazar, Hein Huss and Isaac Commandore moved forward among the first folk, repelled by the stench and the pressure of alien flesh, but drawn by curiosity. They were neither heeded nor halted. They wandered everywhere about the settlement. One area seemed to be an enormous zoo, divided into a number of sections. The purpose of one of these sections, a kind of range 200 feet long, was all too clear. At one end, a human corpse hung on a rope, a Fa'id casualty from the battle at the New Planting. Certain of the wasps flew straight at the corpse. Just before contact, they were netted and removed. Others flew up and away, or veered toward the first folk who stood along the side of the range. These latter also were netted and killed at once. The purpose of the business was clear enough. Examining some of the other activity in this new light, the Jinxmen were able to interpret much that had hitherto puzzled them. They saw beetles, tall as dogs, with heavy saw-toothed pincers, attacking objects resembling horses. Pens of insects even larger, long, narrow, segmented, with dozens of heavy legs and nightmare heads. All these creatures, wasps, beetles, centipedes, in smaller and less formidable form, were indigenous to the forest. It was plain that the first folk had been practicing selective breeding for many years, perhaps centuries. Not all the activity was warlike. Moths were trained to gather nuts, worms to gnaw straight holes through timber. In another section, caterpillars chewed a yellow mash, molded it into identical spheres. Much of the evil odor emanated from the zoo. The Jinxmen departed without reluctance and returned to the wagon. Sam Salazar pitched the tent and built a fire, while Hein Huss and Isaac Commandore discussed the settlement. Night came. The blocks of foam glowed with imprisoned light. The activity underneath proceeded without cessation. The Jinxmen retired to the tent and slept, while Sam Salazar stood guard. The following day, Hein Huss was able to engage one of the first folk in conversation. It was the first attention of any sort given to them. The conversation was long. Hein Huss reported only the gist of it to Lord Fayed. Isaac Commandore turned away, ostentatiously disassociating himself from the matter. Hein Huss, first of all, had inquired as to the purpose of the sinister preparations, the wasps, beetles, centipedes, and the like.
"We intend to kill men," the creature had reported ingenuously. "We intend to return to the moss. This has been our purpose ever since men appeared on the planet."
Huss had stated that such an ambition was short-sighted, that there was ample room for both men and first folk on Pangborn.
"The first folk," said Hein Huss, "should remove their traps and cease their efforts to surround the keeps with forest."
"No,"
came the response.
"Men are intruders. They mar the beautiful moss. All will be killed."
Isaac Commandore returned to the conversation.
"I noticed here a significant fact. All the first folk within sight had ceased their work."
All looked toward us, as if they too participated in the discussion. I reached the highly important conclusion that the First Folk are not complete individuals, but components of a larger unity, joined to a greater or less extent by a telepathic phase not unlike our own.
Einhaus continued placidly,
I remarked that if we were attacked, many of the First Folk would perish. The creatures showed no concern, and in fact implied much of what Jinxman Commandore had already induced. There are always more in the cells to replace the elements which die. But if the community becomes sick, all suffer. We have been forced into the forests, into a strange existence. We must arm ourselves and drive away the men, and to this end we have developed the methods of men to our own purposes.
Isaac Commandore spoke.
Needless to say, the creature referred to the ancient men, not ourselves.
In any event, said Lord Faid, they leave no doubt as to their intentions. We should be fools not to attack them at once, with every weapon at our disposal.
Einhaus continued imperturbably.
The creature went on at some length. We have learned the value of irrationality. Irrationality, of course, was not his word or even his meaning. He said something like, a series of vaguely motivated trials, as close as I can translate. He said, we have learned to change our environment. We use insects and trees and plants and water slugs. It is an enormous effort for us who would prefer a placid life in the moss. But you men have forced this life on us, and now you must suffer the consequences. I pointed out once more that men were not helpless, that many First Folk would die. The creature seemed unworried. The community persists. I asked a delicate question. If your purpose is to kill men, why do you allow us here? He said, the entire community of men will be destroyed. Apparently, they believe the human society to be similar to their own, and therefore regard the killing of three wayfaring individuals as pointless effort.
Lord Faid laughed grimly.
To destroy us, they must first win past Hellmouth, then penetrate Faid Keep. This they are unable to do.
Isaac Commandore resumed his report.
At this time, I was already convinced that the problem was one of hoodooing not an individual, but an entire race. In theory, this should be no more difficult than hoodooing one. It requires no more effort to speak to 20 than to one. With this end in view, I ordered the apprentice to collect substances associated with the creatures. Skin flakes, foam, droppings, all other exudations obtainable. While he did so, I tried to put myself in rapport with the creatures. It is difficult, for their telepathy works across a different stratum from ours. Nevertheless, to a certain extent, I have succeeded.
Then you can hoodoo the First Folk?
Asked Lord Faid.
I vouchsafe nothing until I try. Certain preparations must be made.
Go then, make your preparations.
Commandore rose to his feet and, with a sly side glance for Hein Huss, left the room. Huss waited, pinching his chin with heavy fingers. Lord Faid looked at him coldly.
You have something to add?
Huss grunted, hoisted himself to his feet.
I wish that I did. But my thoughts are confused. Of the many futures, all seem troubled and angry. Perhaps our best is not good enough.
Lord Faid looked at Hein Huss with surprise. The massive head Jinxman had never before spoken in terms so pessimistic and melancholy.
Speak then. I will listen.
Hein Huss said gruffly,
If I knew any certainties, I would speak gladly. But I am merely beset by doubts. I fear that we can no longer depend on logic and careful jinxmanship. Our ancestors were miracle workers, magicians. They drove the First Folk into the forest. To put us to flight in our turn, the First Folk have adopted the ancient methods, random trial and purposeless empiricism. I am dubious. Perhaps we must turn our backs on sanity, and likewise return to the mysticism of our ancestors.
Lord Faid shrugged.
If Isaac...
Commandore can hoodoo the first folk. Such a retreat may be unnecessary.
The world changes, said Heinhus. Of so much I feel sure. The old days of craft and careful knowledge are gone. The future is for men of cleverness and imagination, untroubled by discipline. The unorthodox Sam Salazar may become more effective than I. The world changes.
Lord Faid smiled his sour, dyspeptic smile.
When that day comes, I will appoint Sam Salazar head jinxman, and also name him Lord Faid, and you and I will retire together to Hut on the Downs.
Heinhus made a heavy, fateful gesture and departed. 10. 2 days later, Lord Faid, coming upon Isaac Commandore, inquired as to his progress. Commandore took refuge in generalities. After another 2 days, Lord Faid inquired again, and this time insisted on particulars. Commandore grudgingly led the way to his workroom, where a dozen cabalmen, spellbinders, and apprentices worked around a large table, building a model of the first folk settlement in Wildwood.
Along the lake shore, said Commandore, I will range a great number of dolls, daubed with first folk essences. When this is complete, I will work up a hoodoo and blight the creatures.
Good. Perform well.
Lord Faid departed the workroom, mounted to the topmost pinnacle of the keep, to the cupola where the ancestral weapon Hellmouth was housed.
Jambart, where are you?
Weapon-tender Jambart, short, blue-jowled, red-nosed, and big-bellied, appeared.
Maynard?
I come to inspect Hellmouth. It is prepared for instant use?
Prepared, my lord, and ready. Oiled, greased, polished, scraped, burnished, tended. Every part smooth as an egg.
Lord Faid made a scowling examination of Hellmouth. A heavy cylinder, 6 feet in diameter, 12 feet long, studded with half-domes interconnected with tubes of polished copper. Jambart undoubtedly had been diligent. No trace of dirt or rust or corrosion showed. All was gleaming metal. The snout was covered with a heavy plate of metal and tarred canvas. The ring upon which the weapon swiveled was well-greased. Lord Faid surveyed the four horizons. To the south was fertile Faid Valley. To the west, open downs. To north and east, the menacing loom of Wildwood. He turned back to Hellmouth and pretended to find a smear of grease. Jambart boiled with expostulations and protestations. Lord Faid uttered a grim warning, enjoining less laxity, then descended to the workroom of Heinhus. He found the head jinxman reclining on a couch, staring at the ceiling. At a bench stood Sam Salazar, surrounded by bottles, flasks, and dishes. Lord Faid stared balefully at the confusion.
"What are you doing?"
he asked the apprentice.
Sam Salazar looked up guiltily. "Nothing in particular, my lord."
"If you are idle, go then and assist Isaac Commandore."
"I am not idle, Lord Faid."
"Then what do you do?"
Sam Salazar gazed sulkily at the bench.
"I don't know."
"Then you are idle."
"No, I am occupied. I pour various liquids on this foam. It is first folk foam. I wonder what will happen. Water does not dissolve it, nor spirits. Heat chars and slowly burns it, emitting a foul smoke."
Lord Faid turned away with a sneer.
"You amuse yourself as a child might. Go to Isaac Commandore. He can find use for you. How do you expect to become a jinxman, dabbling and prattling like a baby among pretty rocks?"
Heinhus gave a deep sound, a mingling of sigh, snort, grunt, and clearing of the throat.
"He does no harm, and Isaac Commandore has hands enough. Salazar will never become a jinxman. That has been clear a long time."
Lord Faid shrugged.
"He is your apprentice and your responsibility. Well, then, what news from the keeps?"
Heinhus, groaning and wheezing, swung his legs over the edge of the couch.
"The lords share your concern, to greater or lesser extent. Your close allies will readily place troops at your disposal. The others, likewise, if pressure is brought to bear."
Lord Faid nodded in dour satisfaction.
"For the moment, there is no urgency. The first folk hold to their forests.
Faid Keep, of course, is impregnable, although they might ravage the valley. He paused thoughtfully. Let Isaac Commandori cast his hoodoo. Then we will see. From the direction of the bench came a hiss, a small explosion, a whiff of acrid gas. Sam Salazar turned guiltily to look at them, his eyebrows singed. Lord Faid gave a snort of disgust and strode from the room.
What did you do?
Hein Huss inquired in a colorless voice.
I don't know.
Now Hein Huss likewise snorted in disgust.
Ridiculous. If you wish to work miracles, you must remember your procedures. Miracle working is not jinxmanship with established rules and guides. In matters so complex, it is well that you take notes so that the miracles may be repeated.
Sam Salazar nodded in agreement and turned back to the bench. 11. Late during the day, news of new First Folk truculence reached Faid Keep. On Honey Moss Hill, not far west of Forest Market, a camp of shepherds had been visited by a wandering group of First Folk who began to kill the sheep with thorn swords. When the shepherds protested, they too were attacked, and many were killed. The remainder of the sheep were massacred. The following day came other news. Four children swimming in Brastock River at Gilbert Ferry had been seized by enormous water beetles and cut into pieces. On the other side of Wildwood, in the foothills immediately below Castle Cloud, peasants had cleared several hillsides and planted them to vines. Early in the morning, they had discovered a horde of black, disc-like flukes devouring the vines, leaves, branches, trunks, and roots. They set about killing the flukes with spades and at once were stung to death by wasps. Adam McAdam reported the incidents to Lord Faid, who went to Isaac Commandori in a fury.
How soon before you are prepared?
I am prepared now, but I must rest and fortify myself. Tomorrow morning I work the hoodoo.
The sooner the better. The creatures have left their forest. They are out killing men.
Isaac Commandori pulled his long chin.
That was to be expected. They told us as much.
Lord Faid ignored the remark.
Show me your tableau.
Isaac Commandori took him into his workroom. The model was now complete, with the masses of simulated First Folk properly daubed and sensitized, each tied with a small wad of foam. Isaac Commandori pointed to a pot of dark liquid.
I will explain the basis of the hoodoo. When I visited the camp, I watched everywhere for powerful symbols. Undoubtedly, there were many at hand, but I could not discern them. However, I remembered a circumstance from the battle at the planting. When the creatures were attacked, threatened with fire, and about to die, they spewed foam of dull purple color. Evidently, this purple foam is associated with death. My hoodoo will be based upon this symbol.
Rest well, then, so that you may hoodoo to your best capacity.
The following morning, Isaac Commandori dressed in long robes of black and set a mask of the demon Nard on his head to fortify himself. He entered his workroom, closed the door. An hour passed, 2 hours. Lord Faid sat at breakfast with his kin, stubbornly maintaining a pose of cynical unconcern. At last, he could contain himself no longer and went out into the courtyard where Commandori's underling stood fidgeting and uneasy.
Where is Hein Huss? Demanded Lord Faid. Summon him here.
Hein Huss came stumping out of his quarters. Lord Faid motioned to Commandori's workshop.
What is happening? Is he succeeding?
Hein Huss looked toward the workshop.
He is casting a powerful hoodoo. I feel confusion. Anger. In Commandori or in the First Folk? I am not in rapport. I think he has conveyed a message to their minds. A very difficult task, as I explained to you. In this preliminary aspect, he has succeeded.
Preliminary? What else remains?
The two most important elements of the hoodoo, the susceptibility of the victim and the appropriateness of the symbol.
Lord Faid frowned.
You do not seem optimistic. I am uncertain. Isaac Commandori may be right in his assumption. If so, and if the First Folk are highly susceptible, today marks a great victory, and Commandori will achieve tremendous mana.
Lord Faid stared at the door to the workshop.
What now?
Hein Huss's eyes went blank with concentration.
Isaac Commandori is near death. He can hoodoo no more today.
Lord Faid turned, waved his arm to the Gabalnin.
Enter the workroom. Assist your master.
The Cabal men raced to the door, flung it open. Presently they emerged, supporting the limp form of Isaac Commodore, his black robe spattered with purple foam. Lord Faid pressed close.
What did you achieve? Speak!
Isaac Commodore's eyes were half closed, his mouth hung loose and wet.
I spoke to the first folk, to the whole race. I sent the symbol into their minds.
His head fell limply sidewise. Lord Faid moved back.
Take him to his quarters. Put him on his couch.
He turned away, stood indecisively, chewing at his drooping lower lip.
Still, we do not know the measure of his success.
Ah, said Hein-Huss. But we do.
Lord Faid jerked around.
What is this? What do you say?
I saw into Commandori's mind.
He used the symbol of purple foam. With tremendous effort, he drove it into their minds. Then he learned that purple foam means not death. Purple foam means fear for the safety of the community. Purple foam means desperate rage.
In any event, said Lord Faid after a moment, there is no harm done. The first folk can hardly become more hostile. 3 hours later, a scout rode furiously into the courtyard, threw himself off his horse, ran to Lord Faid.
The first folk have left the forest. A tremendous number, thousands. They are advancing on Faid Keep.
Let them advance, said Lord Faid. The more the better. Jambart, where are you?
Yes, sir.
Prepare Hellmouth. Hold all in readiness.
Hellmouth is always ready, sir.
Lord Faid struck him across the shoulders.
Off with you. Bernard!
The sergeant of the Faid troops came forward.
Ready, Lord Faid.
The first folk attack. Armor your men against wasps. Feed them well. We will need all our strength.
Lord Faid turned to Hein-Huss.
Send to the keeps, to the manor houses. Order our kinsmen to join us with all their troops and all their armor. Send to Belgard Hall, to Bog Houghton, Camber, and Candlewade. Haste, haste! It is only hours from Wildwood.
Huss held up his hand.
I have already done so. The keeps are warned. They know your need.
And the first folk, can you feel their minds?
No.
Lord Faid walked away. Hein-Huss lumbered out the main gate, walked around the keep, casting appraising glances up the black walls of the squat towers, windowless and proof even against the ancient miracle weapons. High on top the great parasol roof, Jambart the weapon tender worked in the cupola, polishing that which already glistened, greasing surfaces already heavy with grease. Hein-Huss returned within. Lord Faid approached him, mouth hard, eyes bright.
What have you seen?
Only the keep, the walls, the towers, the roof, and Hellmouth.
And what do you think?
I think many things.
You are non-committal. You know more than you say. It is best that you speak, because if Faid Keep falls to the savages, you die with the rest of us.
Hein-Huss's water-clear eyes met the brilliant black gaze of Lord Faid.
I know only what you know. The first folk attack. They have proved they are not stupid. They intend to kill us. They are not jinxmen. They cannot afflict us or force us out. They cannot break in the walls. To burrow under, they must dig through solid rock. What are their plans? I do not know. Will they succeed? Again, I do not know. But the day of the jinxman and his orderly array of knowledge is past. I think that we must grope for miracles, blindly and foolishly, like Salazar pouring liquids on foam.
A troop of armored horsemen rode in through the gates, warriors from nearby Belgard Hall. And as the hours passed, contingents from other keeps came to Faid Keep, until the courtyard was dense with troops and horses. 2 hours before sunset, the first folk were sighted across the downs. They seemed a very large company, moving in an undisciplined clot, with a number of stragglers, forerunners, and wanderers out on the flanks. The hotbloods from outside keeps came clamoring to Lord Faid, urging a charge to cut down the first folk. They found no seconding voices among the veterans of the battle at the planting. Lord Faid, however, was pleased to see the dense mass of first folk.
Let them approach only a mile more, and Hellmouth will take them. Jambart?
At your call, Lord Faid.
Come, Hellmouth speaks.
He strode away with Jambart after. Up to the cupola they climbed.
Roll forth, Hellmouth, directed against the savages.
Jambart leaped to the glistening array of wheels and levers. He hesitated in perplexity, then tentatively twisted a wheel. Hellmouth responded by twisting slowly around on its radial track to the groan and chatter of long frozen bearings. Lord Fayed's brows lowered into a menacing line.
I hear evidence of neglect.
Neglect, my lord, never! Find one spot of rust, a shadow of grime, you may have me whipped.
What is that sound?
That is internal and invisible, none of my responsibility.
Lord Fayed said nothing. Hellmouth now pointed toward the great pale tide from Wildwood. Jambot twisted a second wheel, and Hellmouth thrust forth its heavy snout. Lord Fayed, in a voice harsh with anger, cried,
The cover, fool!
An oversight, my lord, easily repaired.
Jambot crawled out along the top of Hellmouth, clinging to the protuberances for dear life, with below only the long, smooth sweep of roof. With considerable difficulty, he tore the covering loose, then, grunting and cursing, inched himself back, jerking with his knees, rearing his buttocks. The first folk had slowed their pace a trifle, the main body only a half-mile distant.
Now, said Lord Fayed in high excitement, before they disperse, we exterminate them.
He sighted through a telescopic tube, squinting through the dimness of internal films and incrustations, signaled to Jambot for the final adjustments.
Now, fire!
Jambot pulled the firing lever. Within the great metal barrel came a sputter of clicking sounds. Hellmouth whined, roared. Its snout glowed red, orange, white, and out poured a sudden gout of blazing purple radiation, which almost instantly died. Hellmouth's barrel quivered with heat, fumed, seethed, hissed. From within came a faint pop. Then there was silence. 100 yards in front of the first folk, a patch of moss burnt black where the bolt had struck. The aiming device was inaccurate. Hellmouth's bolt had killed perhaps 20 of the first folk vanguard. Lord Fayed made feverish signals.
Quick, raise the barrel. Now, fire again.
Jambot pulled the firing arm. To no avail. He tried again with the same lack of success.
Hellmouth evidently is tired.
Hellmouth is dead, cried Lord Fayed. You have failed me. Hellmouth is extinct.
No, no, protested Jambot. Hellmouth rests. I nurse it as my own child. It is polished like glass. Whenever a section wears off or breaks loose, I neatly remove the fracture and every trace of cracked glass.
Lord Fayed threw up his arms, shouted in vast, inarticulate grief, ran below.
Huss! Hein Huss!
Hein Huss presented himself.
What is your will? Hellmouth has given up its fire. Conjure me more fire for Hellmouth, and quickly.
Impossible.
Impossible? Cried Lord Fayed. That is all I hear from you. Impossible, useless, impractical. You have lost your ability. I will consult Isaac Commandore.
Isaac Commandore can put no more fire into Hellmouth than can I.
What sophistry is this? He puts demons into men. Surely he can put fire into Hellmouth.
Come, Lord Fayed, you are overwrought. You know the difference between jinxmanship and miracle working.
Lord Fayed motioned to a servant.
Bring Isaac Commandore here to me.
Isaac Commandore, face haggard, skin waxy, limped into the courtyard. Lord Fayed waved peremptorily.
I need your skill. You must restore fire to Hellmouth.
Commandore darted a quick glance at Hein Huss, who stood solid and cold. Commandore decided against dramatic promises that could not be fulfilled.
I cannot do this, my lord.
What? You tell me this, too?
Remark the difference, Lord Fayed, between man and metal. A man's normal state is something near madness. He is at all times balanced on a knife edge between hysteria and apathy. His senses tell him far less of the world than he thinks they do. It is a simple trick to deceive a man, to possess him with a demon, to drive him out of his mind, to kill him. But metal is insensible. Metal reacts only as its shape and condition dictates, or by the working of miracles.
Then you must work miracles.
Impossible.
Lord Fayed drew a deep breath, collected himself. He walked swiftly across the court.
My armor, my horse. We attack.
The column formed, Lord Fayed at the head. He led the knights through the portals with armored footmen behind.
Beware the foam,
called Lord Fayed.
Attack, strike, cut, draw back. Keep your visors drawn against the wasps. Each man must kill 100.
Attack!
The troop rode forth against the horde of first folk, knights in the lead. The hooves of the horses pounded softly over the thick moss. In the west, the large, pale sun hung close to the horizon. 200 yards from the first folk, the knights touched the club-headed horses into a lope. They raised their swords and, shouting, plunged forward, each man seeking to be first. The clotted mass of first folk separated. Black beetles darted forth, and after them, long, segmented centipede creatures. They dashed among the horses, mandibles clicking, snouts slashing. Horses screamed, reared, fell over backwards. Beetles cut open armored knights as a dog cracks a bone. Lord Faid's horse threw him and ran away. He picked himself up, hacked at a nearby beetle, lopped off its front leg. It darted forward, he lopped off the leg opposite. The heavy head dipped, tore up the moss. Lord Faid cut off the remaining legs, and it lay helpless.
Retreat! He bellowed. Retreat!
The knights moved back, slashing and hacking at beetles and centipedes, killing or disabling all which attacked.
Form into a double line, knights and men. Advance slowly, supporting each other.
The men advanced. The first folk dispersed to meet them, armed with their thorn swords and carrying pouches. 10 yards from the men, they reached into the pouches, brought forth dark balls, which they threw at the men. The balls broke and spattered on the armor.
Charge!
Bawled Lord Faid. The men sprang forward into the mass of first folk, cutting, slashing, killing.
Kill!
Called Lord Faid in exultation.
Leave not one alive!
A pang struck him, a sting inside his armor, followed by another and another. Small things crawled inside the metal, stinging, biting, crawling. He looked about. On all sides were harassed expressions, faces working in anguish. Sword arms fell limp as hands beat on the metal, futilely trying to scratch, rub. Two men suddenly began to tear off their armor.
Retreat! Cried Lord Faid. Back to the keep!
The retreat was a rout, the soldiers shedding articles of armor as they ran. After them came a flight of wasps, a dozen or more, and half as many men cried out as the poison prongs struck into their backs. Inside the keep stormed the disorganized company, casting aside the last of their armor, slapping their skin, scratching, rubbing, crushing the ferocious red mites that infested them.
Close the gates! Roared Lord Faid.
The gates slid shut. Faid Keep was besieged. 12. During the night, the first folk surrounded the keep, forming a ring 50 yards from the walls. All night there was motion, ghostly shapes coming and going in the starlight. Lord Faid watched from a parapet until midnight, with Hein Huss at his side. Repeatedly he asked,
"What of the other keeps? Do they send further reinforcements?"
To which Hein Huss each time gave the same reply.
"There is confusion and doubt. The keep lords are anxious to help, but do not care to throw themselves away. At this moment they consider and take stock of the situation."
Lord Faid at last left the parapet, signaling Hein Huss to follow. He went to his trophy room, threw himself into a chair, and motioned Hein Huss to be seated. For a moment he fixed the jinxmen with a cool, calculating stare. Hein Huss bore the appraisal without discomfort.
"You are head jinxman," said Lord Faid finally. "For 20 years you have worked spells, cast hoodoos, performed auguries, more effectively than any other jinxman of Pangborn. But now I find you inept and listless. Why is this?"
"I am neither inept nor listless. I am unable to achieve beyond my abilities. I do not know how to work miracles. For this you must consult my apprentice, Sam Salazar, who does not know either, but who earnestly tries every possibility and many impossibilities."
"You believe in this nonsense yourself. Before my very eyes, you become a mystic."
Hein Huss shrugged.
"There are limitations to my knowledge. Miracles occur, that we know. The relics of our ancestors lie everywhere. Their methods were supernatural, repellent to our own mental processes. But think, using these same methods, the first folk threatened to destroy us. In the place of metal, they use living flesh, but the result is similar. The men of Pangborn, if they assemble and accept casualties, can drive the first folk back to Wildwood, but for how long? A year? 10 years? The first folk plant new trees, dig more traps, and presently come forth again with more terrible weapons. Flying beetles, large as a horse, wasps strong enough to pierce armor, lizards to scale the walls of Faid Keep."
Lord Faid pulled at his chin.
And the Jinxmen are helpless. You saw for yourself. Isaac Komondori intruded enough into their consciousness to anger them. No more. So then, what must we do?
Hein Huss held out his hands.
I do not know. I am Hein Huss, Jinxman. I watch Sam Salazar with fascination. He learns nothing, but he is either too stupid or too intelligent to be discouraged. If this is the way to work miracles, he will work them.
Lord Faid rose to his feet.
I am deathly tired. I cannot think. I must sleep. Tomorrow we will know more.
Hein Huss left the trophy room, returned to the parapet. The ring of first folk seemed closer to the walls, almost within dart range. Behind them and across the moors stretched a long, pale column of marching first folk. A little back from the keep, a pile of white material began to grow, larger and larger as the night proceeded. Hours passed. The sky lightened, the sun rose in the east. The first folk tramped the downs like ants, bringing long bars of hardened foam down from the north, dropping them into piles around the keep, returning into the north once more. Lord Faid came up on the parapet, haggard and unshaven.
What is this? What do they do?
Bernard, the sergeant, responded.
They puzzle us all, my lord.
Hein Huss, what are the other keeps?
They have armed and mounted. They approach cautiously.
Can you communicate our urgency?
I can, and I have done so. I have only accentuated their caution.
Bah!
Cried Lord Faid in disgust.
Warriors they call themselves, loyal and faithful allies.
They know of your bitter experience, said Hein Huss. They ask themselves reasonably enough what they can accomplish which you, who are already here, cannot do first.
Lord Faid laughed sourly.
I have no answer for them. In the meantime, we must protect ourselves against the wasps. Armor is useless. They drive us mad with mites. Bernard.
Yes, Lord Faid.
Have each of your men construct a frame 2 feet square, fixed with a short handle. To these frames should be sewed a net of heavy mesh. When these frames are built, we will sally forth, 2 soldiers to guard 1 half-armored knight on foot.
In the meantime, said Hein Huss, the first folk proceed with their plans.
Lord Faid turned to watch. The first folk came close up under the walls, carrying rods of hardened foam.
Bernard, put your archers to work. Aim for their heads.
Along the walls, bowmen cocked their weapons. Darts spun down into the first folk. A few were affected, turned and staggered away. Others plucked away the bolts without concern. Another flight of bolts, a few more first folk were disabled. The others planted the rods in the moss, exuded foam in great gushes, their back flaps vigorously pumping air. Other first folk brought more rods, pushed them into the foam. Entirely around the keep, close under the walls, extended the mound of foam. The ring of first folk now came close, and all gushed foam. It bulked up swiftly. More rods were brought, thrust into the foam, reinforcing and stiffening the mass.
More darts, barked Lord Faid. Aim for their heads. Bernard, your men, have they prepared the wasp nets?
Not yet, Lord Faid. The project requires some little time.
Lord Faid became silent. The foam, now 10 feet high, rapidly piled higher. Lord Faid turned to Hein Huss.
What do they hope to achieve?
Hein Huss shook his head.
For the moment, I am uncertain.
The first layer of foam had hardened. On top of this, the first folk spewed another layer, reinforcing again with the rods, crisscrossing, horizontal and vertical. 15 minutes later, when the second layer was hard, the first folk emplaced and mounted rude ladders to raise a third layer. Surrounding the keep now was a ring of foam 30 feet high and 40 feet thick at the base.
Look, said Hein Huss. He pointed up. The parasol roof overhanging the walls ended only 30 feet above the foam. A few more layers and they will reach the roof.
So then? Asked Lord Faid.
The roof is as strong as the walls.
And we will be sealed within.
Lord Faid studied the foam in the light of this new thought. Already the first folk, climbing laboriously up ladders along the outside face of their wall of foam,
were preparing to lay on a fourth layer. First, rods, stiff and dry, then great gushes of white. Only 20 feet remained between roof and foam. Lord Faid turned to the sergeant.
Prepare the men to sally forth.
What are the wasp nets, sir?
Are they almost finished?
Another 10 minutes, sir.
Another 10 minutes will see us smothering. We must force a passage through the foam.
10 minutes passed, and 15. The first folk created ramps behind their wall, first dozens of the rods, then foam, and on top, to distribute the weight, reed mats. Bernard the sergeant reported to Lord Faid.
We are ready.
Good.
Lord Faid descended into the courtyard. He faced the men, gave them their orders.
Move quickly, but stay together. We must not lose ourselves in the foam. As we proceed, slash ahead and to the sides. The first folk see through the foam. They have the advantage of us. When we break through, we use the wasp nets. 2 foot soldiers must guard each night. Remember, quickly through the foam, that we do not smother. Open the gates.
The gates slid back. The troops marched forth. They faced an unbroken blank wall of foam. No enemy could be seen. Lord Faid waved his sword.
Into the foam!
He strode forward, pushed into the white mass, now crisp and brittle and harder than he had bargained for. It resisted him. He cut and hacked. His troops joined him, carving away into the foam. First folk appeared above them, crawling carefully on the mats. Their back flaps puffed, pumped. Foam issued from their vents, falling in a cascade over the troops. Hein Huss sighed. He spoke to apprentice Sam Salazar.
Now they must retreat, otherwise they smother. If they fail to win through, we all smother.
Even as he spoke, the foam, piling up swiftly in places, reached the roof. Below, bellowing and cursing, Lord Faid backed out from under, wiped his face clear. Once again, in desperation, he charged forward, trying at a new spot. The foam was friable and cut easily, but the chunks detached still blocked the opening. And again, down tumbled a cascade of foam, covering the soldiers. Lord Faid retreated, waved his men back into the keep. At the same moment, first folk, crawling on mats on the same level as the parapet over the gate, laid rods up from the foam to rest against the projecting edge of the roof. They gushed foam. The view of the sky was slowly blocked from the view of Hein Huss and Sam Salazar.
In an hour, perhaps two, we will die, said Hein Huss. They have now sealed us in. There are many men here in the keep, and all will now breathe deeply.
Sam Salazar said nervously,
There is a possibility we might be able to survive, or at least not smother.
Inquired Hein Huss with heavy sarcasm.
You plan to work a miracle?
If a miracle, the most trivial sort. I observed that water has no effect on the foam, nor a number of other liquids, milk, spirits, wine, or caustic. Vinegar, however, instantly dissolves the foam.
Said Hein Huss. We must inform Lord Faid.
Better that you do so, said Sam Salazar. He will pay me no heed.
13. Half an hour passed. Light filtered into Faid Keep only as a dim gray gloom. Air tasted flat, damp and heavy. Out from the gates sallied the troops. Each carried a crock, a jug, a skin, or a pan containing strong vinegar.
Quickly now, called Lord Faid. But careful. Spare the vinegar. Don't throw it wildly. In close formation now. Forward.
The soldiers approached the wall, threw ladles of vinegar ahead. The foam crackled, melted.
Waste no vinegar, shouted Lord Faid. Forward, quickly now. Bring forward the vinegar.
Minutes later, they burst out upon the downs. The first folk stared at them, blinking.
Charge,
croaked Lord Faid, his throat thick with fumes.
Mind now, wasp nets. 2 soldiers to each knight. Charge, double quick. Kill the white beasts.
The men dashed ahead. Wasp tubes were leveled.
Halt,
yelled Lord Faid.
Wasps!
The wasps came, wings rasping. Nets rose up. Wasps struck with a thud. Down with the nets. Hard feet crushed the insects. The beetles and the lizard centipedes appeared. Not so many as of the last evening, for a great number had been killed. They darted forward, and a score of men died, but the insects were soon hacked into chunks of reeking brown flesh. Wasps flew, and some struck home. The agonies of the dying men were unnerving. Presently, the wasps likewise decreased in number, and soon there were no more. The men faced the first folk, armored only with thorn swords and their foam, which now came purple with rage. Lord Faid waved his sword. The men advanced and began to kill the first folk by dozens, by hundreds. Hein Huss came forth and approached Lord Faid.
Call a halt.
A halt? Why? Now we kill these bestial things.
Far better not. Neither need kill the other. Now is the time to show great wisdom.
They have besieged us, caught us in their traps, stung us with their wasps, and you say halt?
They nourish a grudge 1,600 years old. Best not to add another one.
Lord Faid stared at Hein Huss.
What do you propose?
Peace between the two races. Peace and cooperation.
Very well. No more traps, no more plantings, no more breeding of deadly insects.
Call back your men. I will try.
Lord Faid cried out,
Men, fall back. Disengage.
Reluctantly, the troops drew back. Hein Huss approached the huddled mass of purple-foaming first folk. He waited a moment. They watched him intently. He spoke in their language.
You have attacked Faid Keep. You have been defeated. You planned well, but we have proved stronger. At this moment, we can kill you. Then we can go on to fire the forest, starting 100 blazes. Some of the fires you can control, others not. We can destroy wildwood. Some first folk may survive to hide in the thickets and breed new plans to kill men. This we do not want. Lord Faid has agreed to peace, if you likewise agree. This means no more death traps. Men will freely approach and pass through the forests. In your turn, you may freely come out on the moss. Neither race shall molest the other. Which do you choose? Extinction or peace?
The purple foam no longer dribbled from the vents of the first folk.
We choose peace.
There must be no more wasps, beetles. The death traps must be disarmed and never replaced.
We agree. In our turn, we must be allowed freedom of the moss.
Agreed. Remove your dead and wounded. Haul away the foam rods.
Hein Huss returned to Lord Faid.
They have chosen peace.
Lord Faid nodded.
Very well. It is for the best.
He called to his men.
Sheathe your weapons. We have won a great victory.
He ruefully surveyed Faid Keep, swathed in foam and invisible except for the parasol roof.
100 barrels of vinegar will not be enough.
Hein Huss looked off into the sky.
Your allies approach quickly. Their jinxmen have told them of your victory.
Lord Faid laughed his sour laugh.
To my allies will fall the task of removing the foam from Faid Keep.
14. In the hall of Faid Keep, during the victory banquet, Lord Faid called jovially across to Hein Huss.
Now, head jinxmen, we must deal with your apprentice, the idler and the waster Sam Salazar.
He is here, Lord Faid. Rise, Sam Salazar. Take cognizance of the honor being done you.
Sam Salazar rose to his feet, bowed. Lord Faid proffered him a cup.
Drink, Sam Salazar. Enjoy yourself. I freely admit that your idiotic tinkerings saved the lives of us all. Sam Salazar, we salute you and thank you. Now I trust that you will put frivolity aside, apply yourself to your work, and learn honest jinxmanship. When the time comes, I promise that you shall find a lifetime of employment at Faid Keep.
Thank you, said Sam Salazar modestly. However, I doubt if I will become a jinxman.
No. You have other plans?
Sam Salazar stuttered, grew faintly pink in the face, then straightened himself, and spoke as clearly and distinctly as he could.
I prefer to continue what you call my frivolity. I hope I can persuade others to join me.
Frivolity is always attractive, said Lord Faid. No doubt you can find other idlers and wasters, runaway farm boys and the like.
Sam Salazar said staunchly,
This frivolity might become serious. Undoubtedly, the ancients were barbarians. They used symbols to control entities they were unable to understand. We are methodical and rational. Why can't we systematize and comprehend the ancient miracles?
Well, why can't we?
asked Lord Fayed. Does anyone have an answer? No one responded, although Isaac Komondori hissed between his teeth and shook his head. I personally may never be able to work miracles. I suspect it is more complicated than it seems, said Sam Salazar. However, I hope that you will arrange for a workshop where I and others who might share my views can make a beginning. In this matter, I have the encouragement and the support of Head Jinxman Hein Huss. Lord Fayed lifted his goblet.
Very well, Apprentice Sam Salazar. Tonight I can refuse you nothing. You shall have exactly what you wish, and good luck to you. Perhaps you will produce a miracle during my lifetime.
Isaac Komondori said huskily to Hein Huss,
This is a sad event. It signalizes intellectual anarchy, the degradation of jinxmanship, the prostitution of logic. Novelty has a way of attracting youth. Already I see apprentices and spellbinders whispering in excitement. The jinxmen of the future will be sorry affairs. How will they go about demon possession? With a cog, a gear, and a push-button. How will they cast a hoodoo? They will find it easier to strike their victim with an axe.
Times change, said Hein Huss. There is now the one rule of Fayed on Pangborn, and the keeps no longer need to employ us. Perhaps I will join Sam Salazar in his workshop.
You depict a depressing future, said Isaac Komondori with a sniff of disgust.
There are many futures, some of which are undoubtedly depressing.
Lord Fayed raised his glass.
To the best of your many futures, Hein Huss. Who knows? Sam Salazar may conjure a spaceship to lead us back to home planet. Who knows? Said Hein Huss.
He raised his goblet.
To the best of the futures.